and welcome to episode 62 of the Creating Crowbar PC Gaming Podcast. It is the 30th of September, otherwise known as Kieran Gillen's birthday, the inventor of games journalism. And with us this evening, I have Chris Thurston.
Hi.
Graham Smith.
Hello.
And special guest, co-founder of Rock Paper Shotgun, and the inventor of social justice, John Walker.
Heaven high.
What? I've never even heard that as an expression before. It's very good.
That's why I thought I'd get my plug for my other podcast in as
heaven
soon as
high.
Possible for the podcast Rumdoings podcast, rumdoings.com. Rumdoings. That is Nick, wow. Nick, my cohort, 1 week decided that by saying hello as a Christian was awful because it's got the word hell and low in it.
Oh, true. So heaven high.
So heaven high is our alternate greeting.
Also, wow, sounds like a 90s. Sort of high school sitcom or something.
It does. Oh my goodness, it's got a heaven high.
That's the most evangelical and also shilling introduction.
You don't carry the lead, do you, John?
Well, is it true, John?
Hi.
That you forged the ring of social justice in the Mount Doom's heart, and you've since used it to enslave the world of men. Is that correct?
That is correct. Why
did you do that?
Now made being a man illegal. Because it's misogynistic to be a man.
It's disgusting.
It is disgusting. So, yeah, that's what I've done.
And coincidentally, you've also been playing a thematically related video game.
Oh, gosh, this is very professional.
I know, it's just, the segues are.
I'm sorry, I said whoa too loudly. I can see that's going to be a problem.
It's fine, we can compress that later.
Okay. Tell us about Shadows of Mordor. It's got a different name.
Shadow of
Middle
it's
Earth.
Called Middle Earth colon Shadow of Mordor.
Yeah, why didn't they go for the Lord of the Rings title? I would have thought they would just slap that in front of it just to make everybody brand aware.
It is odd, isn't it?
Oh, it's a Hobbit, given the first
Yes, but and given it's got Greeblegrobs in it.
Gollum.
That's the one.
Gollum's in it.
Big fan of Lord of the Rings, me.
Greeblegrobs.
Yeah, that's what it's called, right?
Yeah, great.
Is it the Greeblegrobs actor that's playing him?
It sounds an awful lot like him. Okay. I don't think they got Andy Serkis to crawl around in a ping pong suit for the animation, but that seemed to have the right voice.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah.
Like it?
Yes, it's good, isn't it? I've only played it for a day. It's way too difficult at the start. I don't know. I feel really uncomfortable giving too many opinions because I've only started playing it.
That's fine. That's never stopped us before.
Well, good. I've only just downloaded it.
97.3%.
IGN liked it, and that's good enough for me.
That's what counts. It's one of those weird games where the more you fail, the harder it gets, which I'm never quite very comfortable with.
Oh, really?
In a game. Yeah,
what,
so
does it punish you? You have,
there's this system of enemies where if an orc kills you, he then gains notoriety. He then gets a name. They've got this thing, like every enemy has a name. But once one kills you, it then gets given a name, and he gets promoted to a captain.
Captain Gribblegrobs.
Captain, well, no, because you don't have to fight Gribblegrobs.
Oh, okay.
Thankfully. And they kill you again, or if a strong captain kills you, he'll gain more levels every time he kills you. So I've got into this pickle.
How does that work? Does it not reset? Does it reset to a loading point? Are you kind of immortal then?
You're immortal. Well, you're dead at the very beginning. You get killed at the very beginning of the game and then infested by a wraith.
Mm.
And the wraith brings you back to life. And every time you die, you restore at a spirit tower tall thing. Basically, think Assassin's Creed with orcs. And instead of going back to the future when you die, you just get back to a tower when you die.
Like Vita chamber things, like Bioshock, like you just pop out of a...
Yeah, you just respawn.
A ghost does it.
You just respawn. You just respawn at the last...
Fucking ghost
thing. But there's no going back or anything. But that baddie that killed you gets stronger. So the more you fail, the stronger he gets. And there's one baddie, the bastard baddie, who just... I've got him marked as the guy I want to kill because I hate him so much now. And he's the far side of the map. He's continents away from me. And I'll get into one scrap with another named captain. And he'll just pop up and appear every time. And if they're in the fight and survive, they level up as well if you die. They don't even have to be the one to kill you. And so he's like level 20 now, and the rest of the captains are level 4 or 5. And there's this level 20 bastard who just magically... And I don't know if it's a bug, I have no idea. Right now, he's rather spoiling the game. It's like I'm being griefed in the game by a really mean player.
But that sounds... kind of cool. Like, I've seen this thing in trailers and it seems like just a stupid gimmick, but actually it's worked now.
Yeah.
Because now you have
a feeling of vengeance towards mm-hmm. this guy who keeps kicking your ass.
That definitely happens. So I was having a quick look on the Steam forum just in case there was a bug and just in case this guy, anyone else has mentioned, this guy seems to be a bit immortal and turning up all the time. And it doesn't, but there are lots of people saying, oh, I got this one guy who wouldn't come out and I finally killed him and it was amazing. So yeah, that seems to be working really well.
Does anything happen? Do you depopulate things? Does stuff get easier?
No, sadly, again, that doesn't happen either. So if you kill a captain, another orc comes up from the ranks and steps in and gets promoted.
See, I can see them making it harder by buffing kind of individual soldiers who survive if they allowed you to kind of make things easier by just attritionally
go after their underlings and like send their underlings after them.
I'm not sure.
There is that possessing thing. So eventually you can turn orcs to the side and then you can start riots on the ranks.
You get more powerful as you go along, so, and you get more powerful for dying too. It gives you power points for dying. So it's all very peculiar, but I don't know, right now, I want to just run around and play freeform. It's got this open world, you can go off in any direction. It seems that that's the mistake. What I should have been doing is doing at least the first few major quests to get the levels and all the extras. Because I realised after finally going off, and you start with two quest chains at the start. I did one of them, then I was just piddling around. And then I went and did the other one, and after halfway through it, it taught me how to do one of the most basic things I'd had to figure out for myself. And I was like, you're meant to just do as you're told rather than treat it as an open world.
Is the combat Batman-y? Is it Batman-y?
It's very... No, it's a bit simpler, I think.
I think it's only since the advent of video games that Batman has become, like, an adjective. Batman-y.
And Batman's a verb for me.
You're fighting an orc. That's my other big issue with it so far.
I've often walked in on you Batman-ing yourself.
You'll get bombarded. Like, orcs will run in from all directions, and suddenly, like, you'll be fighting three captains at once, and you'll definitely die if you don't run away. Mm. So there's none of that sense of, I can overcome this mob, and you end up with like 10 or 12 of them on you at once, and the game, it's got a strange thing where if you hit someone enough they'll go down but they'll get back up again unless you do a finishing move on them, but that finishing move, it takes forever and the others will attack you during it, cancelling it and hurting you, and so there's this real issue of you knock them down but they're all, you can't manage it, and I end up getting frustrated and running away again. You've played it?
I haven't, but I've just read a shitload of reviews today. I was just aware that there were a few extra systems. It sounds like the kind of thing that... Yeah, I actually look forward to it. I was so ready for it to be shit.
Mm, yes.
Like, it seems guaranteed, almost, really. Yeah. Given the calibre of
previous... It had 6 out of 10 action game that you'll play in a Steam sale in 3 years written all over it. Like, and yet it's not, which is perversely disappointing.
So I've realised what I've done is just gripe about it, but I've actually really enjoyed playing it. So I've griped about that. Those are the main issues I have with it. But actually, when those things aren't happening, when I'm successfully sneaking around and stealth killing and climbing, it's got Assassin's Creed style climbing, which is just point upward and it will climb. Mm. But it's satisfying and leapy and bouncy, and the physics are really great. It feels really meaty and chunky, and I'm actually having a really fun time playing it.
So. I like that Orc society is an almost perfect meritocracy. That's like, did you kill the ranger guy? Have a new job.
And they chat about it too. So if you'll start hearing them talk about you in really cool ways. I think, I've heard rumours that he just sneaks up behind you and you don't even know he's there before he's blades at your throat. You know, oh, that's me. And then if you kill a particular captain, they go, oh, he deserved to die. He was never any good. Or if you meet someone who's killed you like 5 times, they go, oh, I'm sick of killing you. And so it's really responsive, and yeah, it's like, haven't you guy killed you enough times? Oh, I'm going to get you this time.
Good NPC dialogue. That is a Monolith trademark, isn't it? You remember that from No One Lives Forever.
Yeah,
really good. Yes. Really good bad guy dialogue.
It doesn't feel anything like a Monolith game, but it does feel like the quality of a Monolith game, if that makes sense.
Well, I don't know if Monolith is like a studio as was now. I mean, gone through so many Star Trek
games. They went through Gotham Imposters sort of phase.
Yeah, that was obviously a budget game that they made on a shoestring.
Oh yeah,
You can see. I think it was. There was lots of interesting ideas in it, even if it didn't come together. You know.
But what I mean is, like, they were probably better known for sort of story-driven, interesting systems-led single-player stuff, right? And then they went and made a third person.
Who's doing Fear Online? That's coming out like tomorrow, isn't it? Or something.
Really? What?
Soon?
Yeah, it is. But feeling it's been made by an Asian company, isn't it?
I don't know. I have not even looked into it. I just saw it's coming out soon.
Well, Fear 3's multiplayer was surprisingly good. Like, it came with like 12 modes and stuff like that. I'm pretty sure a 0G one.
That's
stuff like that.
Really interesting co-op where one of you plays a ghost.
And
possess things.
Yeah.
Lots of ghosts going to be mentioned on this.
Ghosts are a great excuse to do anything in games, really. You want.
Are Monolith owned by WB now?
Yeah.
They are. Huh. Well, that would explain their sudden...
Harry Potter game next, then. Harry Potter, then...
Harry Potter game where you, like, assassinate Slytherin students and they get replaced by...
Well, how much better would it be to be a Slytherin student where you get to assassinate all the others?
Oh, God, that's going to happen, isn't it?
That would be a good game. Happen. A game where you can just go and kill those insufferable, smug little shits.
Yeah.
That'd be amazing.
I have to say, of all the kind of pleasing things about Shadow of Mordor, I have not been impressed by Warner Brothers' marketing for it, in which they tweeted to other companies like Burger King and stuff like this, with kind of orcs holding, you know, Happy Meals and whatever the Burger King equivalent is. Like, imagine you feel the rumbling of Tolkien's body spinning up his feet.
I love marketing schemes where you can gauge how long the meeting was before they arrived at an idea that was just like, that'll do. Like, the kind of like, when lunch occurred, the exact point was like, yeah, it's just pictures of orcs, send them to Burger King, done.
And in fairness, you can hear Christopher Tolkien's body going, woohoo, and counting money.
Oh, yeah. So.
Didn't he, like, criticise the movies, though, because he thought that they weren't faithful to
his daddy's books? Meanwhile, like meanwhile, he's going to write 400 million chapters into his dad's shopping list and publish it.
Yeah.
Boo! I boo.
Allegedly.
We'll run that past the lawyers first and bleep it
out. Oh, Christopher Tolkien doesn't like to sue. He's fine. Don't worry about him.
Oh God.
Allegedly.
And he's a murderer.
Allegedly.
Oh, Christ. Yeah. Okay. We should move on to another game. Haven't you been playing something else?
I've been playing Sherlock Holmes: Crimes and Punishments.
Is it really called Crimes and Punishments?
It's called Crimes and Punishments.
Well, is that like the James Cameron sequel to Crimes and Punishments?
It is. It has a scene in which Sherlock Holmes is reading Crime and Punishment. And that's it. It's not even relevant to a story. It's just an incidental scene where he pops that book down. And therefore we've called it Crimes and Punishments. It's bloody awful.
Oh. I actually heard.
Everyone else is giving it rave reviews because, as far as I can tell, they're deeply disturbed individuals. I have no idea what's going on. It's atrocious. It's such a big, stinking, steaming pile of cack.
I'd heard really good things. I thought this was meant to be the one that broke the trend of Sherlock Holmes.
Well, so was the last one. So I didn't play the last one. Adam Smith reviewed that for the Mighty Rock Paper Shotgun. And he had a huge, long list of caveats, but still enjoyed it despite them.
Hmm.
Whereas so here's the main issue with the Sherlock Holmes games. What they wanted to do for this one is to allow you to have multiple different endings to each story. So you could have a situation where there's three possible people who could have killed someone. And you interview people and you find clues and blah, blah, blah. And you would imagine what that would do is allow you to narrow it down to who you think is the right one based on all the available evidence, or identify the wrong person for failing to... use all the right evidence. But what it does instead is it wants it to be ambiguous enough that you are able to pick any one of the three and have the chapter conclude that way. So Sherlock Holmes is able to frame. What? Basically, it's about framing someone for a murder. And it doesn't matter which one you pick, it'll end that way. That person will be arrested for the crime. And you can choose two moral endings for each chapter, so you can say that they should be... you can help them get off the crime, which I love. That's a probably Doyle thing to do, and that's really good that that's there. Or you can, or just basically say there are mitigating circumstances and try and get them an easy sentence. Or you can say they should be hanged in the streets. And you can go either way. And you can get anyone murdered, basically. So it's a game about Sherlock Holmes framing people for murder. And the rationale is that it allows this amazing freedom of choice and blah, blah, blah. But it's like an existentialist version of Sherlock Holmes. It's his truth. Who did the murder is Sherlock Holmes' truth.
So, hang on. Run the past me again. Your choices actually dictate who the murderer genuinely was?
No, because... Right. Yes. And so that's what's so insane about it. So you get to the end, and it will play through... you get a unique ending for all of the maybe six different ways a chapter can end. And then it will put up a little screen saying, you've put 67% of people did it this way, and 41%... Actually, there's a made-up numbers because I was playing it pre-release. And then it says you can press space and see whether this was the right answer, but recommends that you don't, so you have your own experience. So of course you do, and it will say it'd be green if you got the right person, or red if you got someone who was wrong, and then you're allowed to replay the ending, the final accusation as many times as you want.
How many innocents did you kill?
I didn't. Do you know, I got it right nearly every time, but only...
That's a trick. What if it always tells you you were right?
No, no, because I got, I did a couple, so there are six chapters, and I think four of them I got the green the first go, and two I got red. And one of them was because of, there's a weapon in one of the games. It's either made of, it's made of two, I don't want to spoil it, but it's made of two different materials, and you've got to figure out which one. And that's one of the chains for just getting to the end. It doesn't change who the murderer was in any sense, but you have to guess or pick which is the right one. All the evidence points to one, and that's the wrong one, and the correct one doesn't make any sense whatsoever. That contradicts everything that's just happened in the chapter. So it's absolute gibberish. So this is all worked by inside. You get to go inside Sherlock Holmes's brain. And every time you find an important clue, you get a little neuron, little ball, and you click on it, and you can choose, like, there's a tobacco pouch dropped to the crime scene in the very first game, and that pops up, and you get two choices for this. One, the tobacco pouch being at the scene proves the owner of the pouch is the murderer, or the tobacco pouch being at the scene means that the person didn't murder them, but was at the scene at some point. But you've got to, that's not a, so your choice with this piece of evidence is the murderer or isn't the murderer? And then when you choose multiple bits of evidence, they form neuron chains, link up. And so you'll come up with other, it'll inform other ideas and you can connect up. It sounds like a nice system to come to the answer, but you have to say the guy who owned the pouch, and you identify who he is the murderer, in order to then be able to say that he's the murderer, in order to be able to conclude that he's the murderer. So it doesn't make any sense on any level whatsoever. The whole thing is completely flawed. Plus the fact it's just this bunch of parochial, tedious, dreary, boring stories that have nothing thematic about them. There's no greater point to any of it. You keep feeling like it's going to, like, his brother shows up. I've just forgotten Sherlock Holmes' brother's name.
Mycroft.
Thank you. Mycroft shows up and starts talking to Holmes about something he wants him to do for the government. And against your own will, Sherlock Holmes goes, "No, I refuse to do any such thing." And oh, where's this going? Nowhere. It doesn't go anywhere. That's the end of that then. A cut scene stops you from going to do anything interesting. It's like, oh, it's about to get interesting. No, no. Sherlock Holmes refused. I've got to go and solve a crime at Kew Gardens instead.
Do you think it's possible to make a good detective game out of Sherlock Holmes, given that Sherlock Holmes is an impossible character, like, even in the books? Yeah. Like, he's not a good character for solving crimes, because there are short stories that Conan Doyle wrote where someone comes in and says, oh, a crime has happened, and Sherlock goes, oh, coincidentally, I've just read a book about this, and I could solve the crime without leaving this room based on this book about flowers that I just read.
Well, the other problem with Sherlock Holmes is all the conclusions he comes to are dependent upon already knowing the answer. So he'll say, I know that the famous opening one with Watson, I know that your brother is an alcoholic because of this pocket watch that you have. And it's all the evidence does fit alcoholic. But of course it fits a myriad of other options. It only works because Doyle writes it so it works. So Holmes is no genius and his methods are gibberish.
He's just a fictional character.
Exactly. But the problem with that is as soon as you're put into Holmes's position, that becomes abundantly obvious. Once you're trying to make these wild conclusions based on spurious evidence, which is what Holmes does. I love Sherlock Holmes, adore the stories. The original stories are wonderful. But the spurious dribble.
There's like almost an amazing deconstruction of Sherlock Holmes in that game. That's what kind of impresses me about it. That system almost lends itself to a game where it's more like Octodad. And you are Sherlock Holmes, and everything you say is taken as gospel truth by the people you're saying it to. And you've just got to try as few innocents as killed as possible while just making like snap judgments based on fucking nonsense constantly. Like, that'd be amazing. Like, yeah.
Life of Brian kind of thing.
Like the wrong guy is accused of being Sherlock Holmes one day and just keeps going with it because people will just do whatever he says in perpetuity.
Plus you have to play as a dog.
What? That improves it.
Yeah, there are sequences where you have to play as Toby Watson's dog. It just follows scents.
To go into vents and things.
Isn't that just the same thing that a murdered soul suspect
did? You can possess cats and murdered soul suspect. What is it with these games? Why do they all have to have a bit where you're an animal?
There's another game where you possess a dog and you can smell things.
Were you also a detective in it? Was it Eleanor?
The previous Sherlock Holmes games did.
Oh, it's in that not terribly good Game of Thrones RPG.
Mm. Oh, really?
You could possess a dog that looked like a meatball. And then it would follow smells.
There are mini games in Sherlock Holmes too. There's an arm wrestling mini game where you have to fuck around with the controls for hours and hours trying to get it so it doesn't break. And then there's a punching mini game where you have to punch a man in the face. And then there's, of course, there's the the cover shooter sequence. But Holmes blindfold shooting a gun in his study and Watson has to dart from furniture to furniture.
You're joking.
No, that's the opening scene of the game.
No way! Is there a turret section?
Do you have to do you have to bait Sherlock Holmes and dive out the way so he gets stuck in a wall and hit him in the back?
Sadly you don't get to play as Watson after that. And Watson is basically just there to be astonished or dismissive, alternately.
Can he teleport, like in previous?
No, the teleportation is completely gone, but he can get in the fucking way! he does this thing where he's, like, on this train platform, there's one chapter that's entirely set on a series of identically modelled, the art's beautiful, but identically modelled train stations. The entire chapter predicated on a map of train stations not having train stations marked on it. The whole mystery is dependent on this railway map, not marking where the train stations are. And Watson will stand on the platform and you've got to walk toward him and you have to basically walk into him and he'll move out of the way. But only, he's like, sometimes he'll just go, he'll look at you and then just take two steps back to still exactly in the sort of blocking your way. And it's like such a dick move and he's got this look on his face. Like,
that was a better idea for a Sherlock Holmes game. What about a Sherlock Holmes game where you play as Detective Lestrade and you have to solve crimes according to actual detective and judicial process ahead of Sherlock Holmes,
who's
approaching with just fucking Deus Ex Machina bullshit and will get the wrong people killed. And every time you're too slow, Sherlock Holmes comes along and ruins everything for you. Play that. That'd be good.
Can you pass my shirt, Greg? I've got to say that on the podcast. It's very hot.
It's been strange. Many topless.
And can you pass my pants?
No, I'm gonna keep those. I would like a game about being a lawyer where you aren't also investigating the crimes. Mm. Like, I like the Phoenix Wright games, but not a lot like being an actual lawyer. But it would be great if you just got brought a bunch of evidence and then had to get a conviction.
Like Papers, even Please, if, but you made more money.
And even if even if you worked out that the person was innocent, if you're a prosecutor, it's still your job to convict them.
Ooh, that'd
be really interesting. Someone make that game.
Wow.
Marsh.
Okay, I'll just get on that.
I don't get why detective games are so hard to make. Well, I do, because they're determined on, I mean, detective stories are all about, like, ambiguities of, like, language and meaning and, you know, what signs actually indicate about a person or a thing. And that's really, really hard to do in a deterministic game. But it seems like the kind of Sherlock Holmes totally solipsistic kind of, like, it's fine.
But it works as adventure games, and that's the odd thing about these games. So the classic point-and-click adventure. You can even go back. Some of those 90s Sherlock Holmes games weren't too terrible. They had FMV, which was problematic. But even like if you just look at a Gabriel Knight or you know, any detective fiction crime-solving adventure game that works, it's weird that Frogwares just seems so reluctant to make an adventure game, despite the fact these are adventure games. They insist on them being first person, even though you still have to be standing next to the object in order to interact with it. And so you're basically just walking around with your nose smooched against walls until you find the one painting in the room of paintings that you're allowed to look at. And you're still forced to do all that crap, but it's in first person, and for some reason has the most atrocious minigames. Also, Sherlock Holmes keeps his instructions for his chemistry experiments in riddles.
So they don't fall into the wrong.
The blue chemical goes three spaces after the yellow chemical, but the white chemical has to be next to the red chemical. That's how he lays out, that's what he does.
What a dick.
I've also been playing a detective game. I think you've played it as well, so I'd be interested to know whether your exasperations with first-person detective games transfer across to The Vanishing of Ethan Carter.
I have played that, yes.
Did you like it? Give me a noise before I launch into it.
That's my noise.
Yeah. That's probably about right.
What did you think of it? It's a bit pretty, isn't it?
It's very pretty.
It is without question the prettiest game I've ever seen. But it's the prettiest non-abstract game. I would say like Proteus maybe does more for me as art, but this is the
it's got a lot of pixels, hasn't it? Oh, a lot of pixels.
Ooh.
They've made them into a lovely, is it Alpine?
I just couldn't stop taking screenshots.
Supposedly
it's
America.
It's bullshit, it's not America. There's no way it's America. Like,
but it was done in Poland, so.
Yeah, but a lot of the graves are in the graveyard are in German. And
it
doesn't
weird.
Look like anywhere in America. Although the characters are called things like Ethan Carter, which doesn't sound very Germanic. But
I wonder whether the German graves was a mistake, like they've forgotten to update some textures.
No, I think all the architecture speaks of Europe, doesn't it?
It's very Scandinavian architecture.
Yeah, there's a church there which is totally a Scandinavian church.
It's a weird church, like tiered. It's a very odd building.
Yeah, anyway, it's a first-person puzzly adventure game. I think lots of people have compared it to Dear Esther, which is a bit of a mistake, I think, because Dear Esther is just a pure narrative game. It's about walking through an environment and just sopping up the story via the
And the other, of course, important thing to remember is that Dear Esther is a stinking pile of utter garbage. This is a really good game, so...
No, well, this has got overt mechanics in it.
Dear Esther is a sixth form's attempt at poetry, whereas this is a mature...
I like to think of it as a one-man fringe play, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, you can say... Yeah, the writing in Dear Esther is overall, but
sophomoric.
I think it conjures like a sense of place in a very effective way. I think that's the comparison with this place, right? They're both very singular places. Dear Esther has this Hebridean
very convincingly
island.
Suggests the sense of place of a hillside. That is unquestionable.
Of a beautiful Hebridean babyness.
In Dear Esther's defense,
and a magic
space
cave.
I think it was interesting looking at Dear Esther now because it does seem quite like simple after things like the Stanley Parable and Gone Home or anything.
Yeah, but
those things wouldn't exist without it, which is sort of interesting.
Exactly, that's why I think it's a bit unfair to kind of point to Dear Esther and say, you're not doing, don't do as much as...
Yeah. In fact, I think it's important to say that I hated it this much at the time.
Yeah, but, we've all been wrong about things. But anyway, so I'm going back to the kind of environment that this is set in. It's set in what seems to be a huge kind of landscape, which will kind of funnel through fairly linearly.
Yeah, so it's basically a very small town either side of a dam.
Yeah.
A railway, a dam, a small
huge
town.
Huge hydroelectric dam that you get on
top of. Yeah, and then couple of industrial buildings.
Surrounded by deciduous forests and giant kind of craggy igneous rocks. And it's not clear from the start exactly how much freedom you have to explore these environments. And I think that's a conflict that doesn't quite resolve in the game. Like, sometimes you walk in a direction thinking, oh, it's allowing me to explore over here. And then you just come up against an impassable, invisible wall. And that's fine up until the point where it asks you to find things within that environment, because it becomes very difficult to interpret exactly what rules it's playing by at any time. And in fact, actually, it opens with a disclaimer, which really, really put my back up.
Mm-hmm,
it says, where is it?
This is not a game that holds your hand.
Yes, this game is a narrative experience that doesn't hold your hand, which I think is developers speak for saying our QA test has got stuck and we couldn't be bothered to fix it.
And it's a game that incessantly holds your hand. It tells you how to do everything every point when you encounter everything.
I don't think it does.
It says press the left mouse on this, hold this button down here, do this, do that. It literally explains everything. Mm. It's either the whole game is a tutorial or none of it is.
Well... I don't know. I got stuck in lots of places and didn't find mechanics that are deep in the game. But I mean, just to go back to the kind of the way it introduces it. Like, I mean, that's its opening. Like, that's the this kind of its remit stated on the screen. And I knew already, having been quite appealed to by the screenshots, look very beautiful. Then I found out it had ghosts in it, which is obviously a negative point because ghosts are just absolving developers of being able to have interactive exposition. That's just it. I was wrong about that. That's unfair. Then it opens up, voiceover. Apparently, you're a paranormal investigator called Paul Prospero. Mm-hmm.
But that's
unfair
spoilers.
About that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
For reasons that we'll come to later in a non-spoilery way.
He's no Dick Shakespeare reference, that's for sure.
And all of that kind of really, I was like, I don't know about this. It looks very pretty, but then you come out of this tunnel, this train tunnel, and you walk a little way down the tracks, and almost immediately, it states the kind of, wow, I was summoned to this town by Ethan Carter, who was a little boy, and he seems to have run into trouble. and then you stumble across two severed legs on the train track.
Yes.
Well, that's a bit on the nose, isn't it? Like, okay, I guess something bad has happened here. And the way, it primarily delivers its puzzles. And this goes back to the hand-holding thing. Like, I think a lot of the puzzles are just kind of pointlessly obscure.
So, okay, I think there's two... I think it has two separate types of puzzles. There's the puzzles that reveal Ethan's stories. And it's like, in my writing review, this was a nightmare, because you don't want to talk about the mechanics and you don't want to talk about the story, because the point of playing the game is to discover both of them. So I'm going to be careful. But you have the puzzles that are after discovering stories, like the... Oh, fair enough. Like the haunted house thing, as it were.
Hmm.
It's not really a haunted house, but you know what I mean. And then the one I missed when I played it the first time, which was the...
Yes, don't put your hands in the paper shredder, Chris. Sorry. Just gently caressing the lid.
I was concerned that the lid wasn't on straight.
Okay.
I'm sorry, continue.
Sorry.
No. I want to see Chris put his hand in the paper shredder.
That's not what we're here for today, John.
Sorry, you were saying puzzles.
Yeah, and then there's like the spaceship thing. And then there's the other side of it, which is this ludicrous chronology thing.
Yeah, this is the main way that puzzles and the mysteries are presented to you in the game are via you coming across crime scenes and you paranormally recreating them using your paranormal psychic powers, which involves finding items that are missing from the scene and then returning it to the scene.
Which is fine, restore things so ghosts are comfortable with it.
It's fine, but unfortunately it involves a lot of searching for items that are very small in a large 3D environment, which aren't flagged up as interactive
items.
You know,
I just got lucky. I imagine you're talking about the rock you have to put on.
Oh, yeah.
I found that rock by mistake.
I found the rock, but I didn't know where to put it.
And if you use your psychic powers on the rock, it tells you that...
You see, this is the mechanic that I didn't discover until the last fucking puzzle in the entire game. It's when you look at when you finally come across an item, which declares itself to be interactive, only when you get very close to it, this kind of big word cloud appears saying, rock, question mark, rock, question mark, rock, question mark, or crack, 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 all these other stuff. And then it turns out, if you move your camera around until that word cloud coalesces into a single point, it gives you a little vision about where the item is.
See, I figure that straight away because I'm a genius.
See, I didn't find that accidentally. And because I'm not actually a paranormal psychic investigator, I didn't know what powers... This is the thing. Like, fine, don't handhold me. Fine. Yeah. And I quite like the fact that it doesn't force exposition down. You are left to discover exactly how the plot unfolds yourself. All that stuff, fine. But when it comes to making an interactive media in which the modes of interaction are esoteric and not told to you, that's just shit. Like, I don't know.
When it came to Crank, I figured out the Crank thing. I don't know where, whether I'd recognise the mechanic from somewhere. I don't know why, but I instantly figured that out. And like, yes, as you say, there's no reason I should have. And if I hadn't, that could have been
I think it's just a matter of being unlucky. Like, I think if you looked in the direction in which the words coalesce to begin with, then you'd instantly work out, hang on, I've noticed a correlation between the motion of my mouse and the fact that these words are coalescing. If you don't do that, then you just never twig for the rest of the game until it accidentally you stumble across it.
So
I spent, and you've got to find this fucking place to put a rock in the middle of a fucking forest. Like, they can go in lots of places. Full of fucking rocks. It's like fucking hunting for a pixel, but a pixel is buried in a forest.
My larger issue with the game, and I really did enjoy it. I found the story to be quite facile, really. It wasn't that original of an idea, and I guess the whole thing. Have you not finished it?
I have finished it, but I don't want anybody to spoil it.
Oh, no, I'm not going to spoil it. I'm far too professional. Just, I guess the whole thing is all I was going to say.
Right, okay.
So, and that kind of took an edge off for having, because when you've guessed the thing, and I never normally do, I'm the kind of person who tries not to guess things, so it's much more fun to have it revealed to you than to go, oh, how clever I was to have been right. But the problem is you get to the very end of the game, and the game won't finish unless you found everything. So you've got this amazing freedom just to walk. You could walk straight past huge parts of the game. And I thought, wow, that's so cool. I love a game that isn't like, come and look at this. But they take control of the camera and swing your head around and go, look at the thing over there. We spent ages on it. And I love that this game wasn't doing that. You could just miss stuff if you didn't notice it. I completely missed the bit with the traps at the very, very start
of the
game.
Yeah, and then you have to walk a long fucking way
exactly.
back.
Exactly. So you get to the very end of the game where it should just end.
And it's pretty much linear.
So
you have to walk a long bloody way.
But you get to the very, very end of the game, and at that point, there's no reason for it not to end at that point. It doesn't require you to have solved all these other things for the narrative to wrap up. It's just an insane game mechanic that it needs you to have done that. And so if it had just let me end, and I'd missed stuff, and then even then could have gone, oh, by the way, you missed a bunch of stuff, and I go, oh, I'll play it again then. Whereas instead, what it said was, right, even though we've given you all this freedom, now you have to go back and game your way through the whole thing. Find everything you missed, and I had to go and do two different things I'd missed, and then come over, blah, blah, blah. And that really kind of took the edge out at the end.
That sounds like it might have been a late addition, only because I remember a PC Gamer preview from like a couple of months ago, 6 months ago, where the developers were boasting about the fact that you could walk through the entire game and get an ending without having done anything. Whereas what that sounds like is someone went, shit.
Yeah.
I mean, and maybe there is some logic in that, players taking the path of least resistance and then judging the entire game based on their path of least resistance.
But they've got their money, so who cares? This is the thing developers have to remember.
Well, people care about how their thing is received, and if people are like, I didn't do anything, I walked to the end.
Well, then everyone else can look at them and go, you're a bloody idiot then, aren't you?
I think it'd be annoying if you, because it's, well, I think the problem is so much of it is easily missable.
Right, for the traps thing is a real mistake because there's, as you said, you only that's a mechanic I hadn't discovered.
I'd walked around that area as well quite a lot, and I just, for whatever reason, just not triggered a trap, didn't see it. And like, there was no reason that I should have been punished in that way because I was looking and I didn't see it.
At the very beginning of the game, did you turn around and go the wrong way up the tunnel? And it brings you out the same place anyway!
Good old Unreal Engine portal technology. Very in fact, talking clever. Of portals, there's what I'm like, I think, other than the whole ghostly solving crimes mechanic, which is kind of a bit duff, there are a number of different puzzles, each of which is quite different from the others, and most of them aren't that great, I don't think, but there's one really good one where you're in a you enter a house, and each doorway in the house becomes a portal, and through that portal you can see a variety of different rooms, only one of which is the real one, and you have to work out, based on your knowledge of that building, which one is actually the correct room behind it. I thought that was really
interesting. I had to draw floor plans. I've got a thing in my brain which doesn't work properly. I don't know what it's like. It's hard to describe it. It's like dyslexia for directions.
Dyspraxia.
I'm not dyspraxic because I've got good spatial awareness, but I can't work out what room's above or below another room in a house. So like
I'm really good at that.
So I was in my parents' house for like 20 years, but I never figured out which room was above the other one. And in my own house I live in now, I still can't do that. And then I can't learn directions, but
imagine living your life not knowing what room is above you.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. So for that puzzle was really, really hard, because I'm trying to remember another building in a, you know, you're in the wrong place and you're doing all this stuff. And so I drew out proper architectural floor plans with doors with the curly line and everything. So that's the only way I could solve the puzzle. But I really enjoyed solving that puzzle that way. That felt like I was back in the 90s solving a really good adventure game puzzle.
Yeah, there's some good kind of write your own notes kind of puzzles in it.
Yeah.
But a lot of, it constantly falls back on finding things in the environment which aren't easy to find because they're just not flagged up very well. But all of that aside, like I was quite liking the narrative. There's lots of kind of, it's about this kid who has a very fanciful kind of imagination, and so throughout the environment you find little stories of his which are then reflected in the environment in quite neat ways.
Yeah.
And he's obviously been, you know, you go find his little hideout. He's been reading lots of Jules Verne and Lovecraft, obviously a big influence.
And Poe.
And Poe, yeah. And so that's kind of appealing. And the mystery in general as to what's happened to this populace, so this small settlement, that's quite interesting. But really, what's weird about it is that, like, there is, like, a major narrative payoff, but it happens, like, in the last maybe a minute of the game. And it's weird. I get why they've done it like that. I don't really see any way they could have seeded that any earlier on. But the problem is that revelation contains the entire meaning of that game. Like, you know, the game doesn't really have any meaning prior to that. It's just a kind of funky yarn. Oh, God.
Funky yarn is the thing that Nan makes a jumper out of.
It's very hot in here. It's understandable.
Yeah, sorry. Reverse it back to like an 80s DJ.
Funky yarn.
but after you get that revelation, it actually has some, you know, modicum of profundity to it, or there's at least,
that's the most credit I think I've ever seen you give a video game.
It's where the emotional payload of the game is, like the emotion that you feel to, you know,
I
meant
feel
to feel
like it's a
characters.
Misfire though. I feel like this is very tedious for anyone. People have either played it and have their own opinions, or they haven't played it and this is just a very annoying conversation. But I feel like there could have been a bigger and better payoff to explain a lot of what had happened. I feel like I want to rewrite the ending. That's my.
I think if they'd seeded that somehow throughout,
maybe
it felt like it was two acts, and then they just went, this is what happens in the third act. Bye.
But here's the thing: out of all these criticisms we've reeled off, I still recommend anyone play because it's just so damned beautiful.
Yeah.
It's ridiculously beautiful. It's just, I called my wife into the room to look at it, and she hates video games. I was like, come in here, and she's like, oh, that's amazing. And she was really excited about
it. They're artists that definitely do awards.
Apparently they reinvented they've invented a new way of doing textures by taking photographs and converting them into pictures. They invented some new technology to create these. The only problem I had with the art, which is exceptional, like the best I've ever seen, is they keep reusing the same buildings, that these non-functional buildings. Those weird ones with the electricity stuff around there and no door to get in. Yeah. Like, why do they there? Oh, and they're just infuriating. Always a building. I'll go to it. Oh, it's that
I think they're meant to be electricity substations. I think you might actually, that's not necessarily plausible that you wouldn't find buildings of a similar type around.
They should have a door or something. You can go inside.
Yeah, it's odd. Like, they seem to have a second story in some of them and there's no way up.
Yeah.
So I don't really get them.
Also, that first house has a tower room that you can't, there's no steps to get into when you get inside. That annoyed me.
Oh.
It does. Okay. I've checked over and over and over again.
But the thing is, with the way that they've modelled those buildings is so kind of idiosyncratic that I'd be surprised if they weren't drawn from actual reality, which is, makes me kind of think that maybe these are badly designed buildings, but not badly designed art assets.
Well, it's just the fact it was the repeated use of the same asset like about five times in the game you come across the same building, which is a shame in such an exceptionally beautiful game.
Good rocks, really good rocks.
Oh my goodness, it's just the sunset. Sunsets are a cheap way of getting good looks, but boy, do they get it right.
Well, that's the thing. It's not going for photorealism. It's going for a heightened kind of realism, which is, you know, as beautiful as the world has ever looked kind of realism, you know?
Yeah. And the trees are incredible. There's this autumnal theme all the way through, which is very much thematic to the storyline it's telling, this idea of things dying beautifully or whatever.
I wasn't so impressed by the branch technology. At a distance, looks pretty
exactly, great. Exactly, but that's what I was going to say. You go up and look up, and you just again, you've just got those flat tessellates, those flat textures against each other, and I just think
that's not procedurally generated.
When we can get to when graphics can get to trees, proper leaves, that's when we're there. Mm. That's when games will be amazing.
Yeah, the leafy watermark.
Here's the funny thing about that. Sorry, I'm just taking over your whole podcast.
That's fine.
No, it's good. Graham speak yet. when Far Cry came out, that was another game where I called people into the room. I had a friend come over and say, oh my goodness, you've got to load up this game, and showed it to him because like, you've never seen anything like this. Like, wow, it's like real life, it's amazing. You load up Far Cry now and it looks like a crappy cartoon. So we're going to one day look at Ethan Carter and we're going to go, what were we thinking? That's really weird to try to get your head around.
Man, you have to look at it with your eyes rather than being projected directly into your brain. How dumb.
That said, Half-Life 2 is the last game I can remember doing that with. And because I started Half-Life 2, and that train station at the start where you look around, it's a big echoey atrium.
Yeah, it's still pretty cool.
Like, and you're like, wow, this is like a real thing. And I restarted the entire game, got my dad and my sister to come and look at it, because you do not want to know how old I was when Half-Life 2 came out.
And I cry.
And
have a look at the game! I love it! What are you doing out of your cot?
What year was that?
2003.
I was 16. So, like,
come and look at this game!
Mom! This is great! Recently, I played it again, and that is...
That's really unfair. Like, any 16-year-old is going to go, that's 13, you old man.
But recently, I ended up playing through it again, without an Oculus Rift, and that space, despite the fact that, yes, it's lower res than we're used to, and the assets are less high quality, like, the atmosphere of that space sells it completely.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I think there's still a degree to which design direction overtakes graphical fidelity to quite a substantial amount. Mm-hmm. And it'd be, like, I mean, it sounds like you're saying that Ethan Carter has both.
Yeah, it does. I think, I wonder how, it'll be interesting to see how quickly it dates, because right now it's just, as you say, it's super real. It's, and I think maybe that's it. Maybe super realness is what dates, and if games could look photorealistic, they would just stay the same.
Yeah.
It was the interesting thing. Carmack started saying, like, 10 years ago, that he was basically irrelevant now, because you start to get a point of diminishing returns of being able to throw more and more polygons and shaders and stuff at the screen. What matters then is design direction, which is why Half-Life 2 still looks great. And you look at it's not just the atmosphere of the places, the faces in that game, still brilliant. And the facial animation is still better than, I mean, we were taking the piss out of Alien Noir, was it last week on the podcast, or whatever. And they've spent a great deal of time doing proper motion capture of people's faces, so you can supposedly tell when they're lying. But they're acting shit, so they all look ridiculous. Whereas Alex still looks brilliant. And Team Fortress 2 as well, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, to digress into the Forbidden Zone, briefly, like, it's the reason, one of the reasons Destiny's easily going to be one of my games of the year, and like,
I thought you were going to say Dota.
Sorry.
The other Forbidden Zone, it's Dota and consoles, and I'm going to the consoles direction. But one of the reasons for that is...
Sorry, which game I yawned through it thinking it was Dota?
Yeah, it's Destiny. One of the reasons for that is that the entire game is beautifully color graded in a way that is really impressive, because the game has a day-night cycle, and it's not only every environment is beautifully graded, so it always looks spectacular no matter what time of day it is in the environment. They've managed to do that across nighttime, sunset, sunset. Like, and every single time you load, you know, the first time you load Venus and it's night, you're like, wow, this place looks amazing. The volcanoes are belching phosphorus and it's kind of like alien but familiar in a way that's really exciting. And then it's daytime and it looks amazing again. Like, that's a really underappreciated skill.
I was going to say, day-night cycles are a great thing apart from the night bit.
Yeah, and they've managed to make night look brilliant. And it's like, everything about that game looks amazing. The menus look amazing. It's like having an art director just take a pass on your game and go, here's the colours that you need to make this nice for the eyes, is a really good thing.
I remember meeting someone. This is just such a terrible story, because I can't remember who, and I can't remember which game it was. It was an artist on the game. He explained to me why all video game faces look so terrible. And he said it's because no one seems to realise that human skin is green and blue and yellow and pink and red and orange. Mm. And that's what he said. Everyone tries to do flesh colour on their characters in their games. Mm. And that's why they always look like demonic waxworks. He said, but if you put the blues and the greens into the skin, suddenly it was like his skins look like skin. Oh, that was an amazing bit of wisdom. Weird that no one else seemed to realise.
It's not stuff to do with lighting as well, because light actually passes through several layers of your skin before it bounces back. And so it's a thing that Pixar do when they're rendering humans now, is that their lighting model actually passes through layers of skin in order to simulate
subdermal scattering, is it?
Wow. Something like that, probably.
That sounds like a thing that you would read.
Yeah, I get very excited when I read those kind of things. Well, you've been playing Greybo, little Greybo with your big beard.
Well, I'll also try and avoid spoilers. I've been playing FIFA 15.
Wow, okay.
Don't say, I'm only halfway through. I have no idea.
I'm actually still on FIFA 10.
you got 5 games to go. This is the 15th game in the series. It's still about football, which you all love, right?
That's the one with the hooks for hands.
It's almost like I wasn't chased into this profession due to social alienation. I'm not bringing it.
You can do both. You can do both things. I always did both things. And then I lost interest in football, and then I got back into football a couple of years ago via FIFA, when it reached a point of parity on PC between the PC version and the console version. We started playing it in the PC Gamer office, much to the chagrin of the other people in the PC Gamer office.
It's been different since that stopped. Really.
Quieter. Less rage.
Well, like, I mean, without wanting to digress, you and Rich playing FIFA every single lunchtime and every after work gave a sense of rhythm to the day that's been lost. Because, like, you know, Sam and I work well together as Dep Ed and Editor, but we don't have that, like, kind of magical time-setting link.
I remember the most obnoxious thing about being in the PC Gamer office was Xbox World playing FIFA. And it was just horrible.
We hated them.
They were a nice bunch of guys, but at lunchtime, they just turned into awful, laddish, lout people. They were really nice. I worked on Xbox World a few times. Bunch of people. But at lunchtime, they were horrible.
Yeah, but no, now it's people do their own thing at lunchtime. Quiet settles upon the room. There is no... There's no hooping. There's no Rich going... like that.
Well, FIFA 15 came out. And it's much the same. And...
the end.
Questions from questions.
I mean, like, I've reviewed the last few FIFA games, and I'm writing about this one at the moment, and I've realised that it's a bit like writing about a new version of an operating system. Mm. In that you end up writing about the changes from the previous version rather than various fundamental assumptions.
Mm.
But the problem with that is that it means that you overlook a whole bunch of flaws in the design, because that they're predicated on those assumptions. And in FIFA, that's the fact that they have decided to ape so closely the presentation of football as it is on television, for in terms of camera angles and animations and that sort of stuff. So this is a football game where the camera is in the stand looking side on towards the pitch, which means you can only ever see about 25 feet in front of your player and 25 feet behind your player, and the distance of the width of the pitch is foreshortened because of the perspective of the camera. Now that's fucking moronic. If you ever think about what you do in this game, which is judge spaces and then pass a ball between it,
you can't reasonably judge how far to your right or left a player is because of the foreshortening, and you can't see far enough in front of you in
order to play long never did this. Passes. ISS 64 was top down. It was much better.
ISS 64 was side on, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't. It was an angled top down, I'm sure.
You might have been able to change the camera around, which is a thing I'm pretty sure you can't do. It's the last time I played a
football game.
You can only move the camera in FIFA in different positions of the stadium. And the thing is, like, if you watch television football, the camera at the very least, television football.
Telly ball, I believe. Isn't it?
Yeah, as opposed to gamey ball.
Meat football.
The camera pivots. It stays in place. It pivots. So when it's got the ball is going towards the goal, you can kind of see the front of the goal. Doesn't do that in FIFA even, so it's not even a good representation of TV. The camera slides along the side of the pitch, so you never get a proper kind of almost even close to a front-on view of the goal. And what this means is that they've got to build in systems to cater to that, which is you basically everyone plays FIFA with passing assist on and some level of shooting assist on and that sort of stuff, so that when you're passing the ball, it's taking roughly the direction that you're pushing, but is also assisting you a little bit and saying, oh, you probably meant that guy over there, so that's the one that the ball I'm going to target the ball towards. And it does similar things with every interaction. You can turn stuff off, turn stuff on, but if you turn everything off, the game is basically just impossible to play because you can't properly judge the space. What this leads to is two things. One is that FIFA is ultimately a game of timing in the way that a fighting game is a game of timing. It's about reading frames of animation and working out at what point you can move the controller and have the game understand your intent. And fighting games, that's the game discerning that, oh, you pushed it at this time, that means you want to do a counter or something like that, or you want to block, and it works based on your timing. In FIFA, it's deciding whether you want to, when you flick the analog stick, kick the ball in front of you and run on to catch up with it, or whether you wanted to switch the player that you were controlling. And the second thing is that it just becomes incredibly frustrating because the game is constantly misjudging your intent because it's guessing at what you want. And you become almost like indoctrinated into this way of, oh, this is how football games are, this is how FIFA is, this is just, and PES is similar because it apes the same stuff because FIFA's been, you know, leading the way for such a long time now. But it's just incredibly frustrating. And every time there is a new FIFA game, they announce what features are going to be in it. So this time it was new systems of emotional intelligence. whole new emotions, which basically means that your players get pissed off at one another if they don't have good chemistry, and if you shoot,
can you romance other players?
Fortunately, not.
Can you commiserate other players on their divorces?
Chemistry is an important thing when it comes to Ultimate Team, which is the kind of card collecting version of FIFA, where you buy, you can spend real money on essentially stickers that have stats.
Someone once hacked my Xbox Live account and spent £100 on FIFA.
Did they?
Yeah, I got it back.
Oh, I've spent actual money on FIFA Ultimate Team. FIFA Ultimate Team is great, and it's always had a chemistry stat, and it's always been pretty pointless. Now it does kind of have a point, because when your players get angry at each other, what they do is they waste valuable time yelling at each other rather than being receptive to the ball you're trying to pass at them. And if their chemistry was particularly low, then you can do things like have a really opposite scoring opportunity, shoot, and the player 30 feet behind you will go, oh, why didn't you pass it to me? And therefore, the ball will then like bop off them a moment later when, you know, the opposing team makes a mistake and that sort of stuff. So that's super frustrating. But
do they have a mode where if you get tackled, you can just roll over to the ground and start crying?
No.
That's apparently that. I watched some of your footballs during, amazing. The World Championship.
Wait, after what you just,
there was a lot of crying.
After what you just said, when you said FIFA Ultimate Team is great, I heard, and we have always been at war with Eurasia.
It used to be a great thing. when you would like try to tackle people in FIFA, it used to be a great thing where the physics engine would cause them sometimes to kind of fall on top of each other and have these tender moments where their arms would get twined and they couldn't break it up.
The best part about PC Game of Lunchtime circa 2012
was kissing. Kissing
was the dental homoerotic kissing.
Yeah.
And in the game.
Still occasionally happens now, but they've specifically added, like,
with Rich in Japan, it's a lot harder to kiss him, isn't it?
But they specifically added, like, anti-gay role animations so that when the players...
Hang on, I'm getting my SJW cape on!
That's the best phrase. Is it called that in the patch notes? Because if it is...
Unfortunately not. But, like, they have
the stop, drop, and roll
now. Yeah, they roll away. Like, if text an accidental gay moment is about to happen, the players will just, like, both roll in the opposite direction.
It's called back-to-wall mode.
If that was based on the chemistry of the players... That would be the best game system ever devised. Or if they don't like each other, they immediately spring apart. But if they do like each other, oh my.
Get off me! Get off me, you woofed up!
Don't get off me. Oh, I mean, yeah. I mean,
oh my, I'm so confused in my trousers! This is amazing. I like the idea of that you get the game continuing afterward back into the shower room and you're like, oh, I'm really angry with you. And then like, oh, I'm not angry with you.
I'm kissing angry.
Yeah, come on, soap.
Well, like, FIFA has become a bunch of different games because there's just regular playing football FIFA. There's FIFA Ultimate Team, which is a sticker collecting game, which is great. And then there's... And there's Be a Pro mode where you can just take control of an individual player and kind of lead them through a career. And
More like Football Manager?
No, you start controlling a player on a pitch, but you're only controlling a single player.
Oh, that sounds good.
Unfortunately, it doesn't do the New Star Soccer stuff, which is a long-running, originally PC football game, which is now really popular on iOS, where you control a single player, and you play games, but you also control their personal lives. So they become famous and celebrities, and you buy cars, and you have wives and affairs, and all the stuff that actual footballers do, allegedly.
No, they are all whores. There's no allegedly about that.
Yes. Name some.
No. The problem with this joke is it relies on my knowing the names of a footballer.
Yeah.
Does the David Posh Beckhams, does he still play the footballs?
No, he's retired. He's co-owner of a football team.
Hang on, I thought, because I knew he played for LA Galaxy. I knew that's the thing that I knew.
Yeah.
And then I thought he went to, like, Paris or something.
He was a PSG for a year and then he retired and now he's back in America and he's teamed up with a bunch of investors and they're starting a football team in maybe Miami or something like that. Man.
Okay.
facts about football.
Me and Graham having a little chat about David Beckham there.
Yeah. Bex.
It's good, wasn't it? Old Pansy Bex.
So there's two grounds in which I can, like, talk about FIFA in that case. Like,
the Manchester United ground and the Arsenal ground.
Yes. You can talk about all the changes that have happened since the last iteration in the series, in which case it's a little bit more attacky now because they've nerfed some defenders and they've changed this and that.
Nerfing a defender in real life.
At which point you just think, it's... First of all, bizarre that this is a yearly series that I have to pay £35 or £40 or £50 for.
You don't have to. By the way, just, you know.
Well, I
we have always been at war with Eurasia.
But, you know, Dota patches are free. And
does your,
much
does your
more
podcast come with a reading list? So people can get all the
that was the most high-brow joke.
Okay.
I think it was the most high-brow.
But like Dota patches, you don't have to pay £50 for them, and they come out more often than once a year. And
sometimes.
A lot of the time, the changes that happen in FIFA are no real greater than what a Dota patch would do. In fact, often they change the game less. And then the other way I can talk about the game is as the fundamental object separate from the series. In which case, it's just got the same frustrations and problems every single year, and it's still a really good game. It's still really fun. Still captures a lot of the drama of football. There are still moments of, I think, physical beauty or grace to the way that the different physics systems are interacting and the ball physics.
So they will know what happened now.
Are brilliant in ways that create moments of serendipity in ways that actual football does. And that's all great. But still, I just spend a lot of the time that I'm playing it really frustrated and angry with things that are outside of my control because the camera angle's dumb.
Here's my argument against the former, the changes review, is that they always infuriate me. Because if I'm reading I'm thinking, oh, actually, I've never played a FIFA game. I might buy FIFA 15. I read this review, and it just tells me how it's different from another game I haven't played. That's awful. I hate that. Don't do that as your boss. I'm telling you not to do that.
I haven't. Don't worry. I also think, like I say, I think the problem with doing the changes review is that you miss over lots of stuff, which is just the same as it always was, except that reviews tend to have a couple of sentences of going, oh, it's still mostly the same, but... Mm-hmm. And then talking about the changes for
when you review that way, you essentially plot a game on a graph. And unless someone is au fait with the entire graph, it's a very unhelpful plotting.
It does sound from what you're saying that the camera changes are so severe that you would prefer to play 2014?
No, but the camera's always been like this. That's what I mean. It's like fundamental assumptions about how a football game should be made and based on certain metaphors that they're using. And which is one of the reasons I make the operating system comparison, because operating systems are always based on the metaphor of a desktop, because that's the way we designed it where they were. And it's rare that anything ever changes that. It's weird when it does.
Oculus Rift enabled?
No.
Just thinking that would solve the distance problem potentially.
Yeah, that would be cool. If you could move your head and lean over like a table that was in front of you while you were playing, that would be great.
I was going to argue that the problem with football games is that you're trying to control 11 people and you can't. And that seems to be the fundamental flaw in all of football gaming. The idea of you're playing as one player also sounds rubbish as well, because not one player only does plays 11th of the game. So it just strikes me as a sport that's inappropriate to be represented as a video game.
It is partly
a strategy game.
True, all sensible soccer.
Turn-based would work. But there are problems with that, and it's the computer trying to guess your intent. And then there are problems with FIFA that are always there that I swear are just there for like game design balance reasons. So for example, if you're outside of the box, you've got two other attackers who are inside the box, and from outside of the box you shoot. The goalkeeper will save it and probably spill it. Mm-hmm. And in real life, one of your other attackers would run in, get on the spilled ball, and score from the deflection. But that would create, in FIFA, where there are a lot of shots over a course of a game, because it's much faster and time is shrunk, that would create a lot of goals that were fundamentally quite unsatisfying, because they were coming from deflections, and it's not a very impressive way to score, nor a very... satisfying way to be scored against. Like, it doesn't take much skill. You would just hit the ball really hard at the keeper would spell it every time, and then you would, because of all the other systems and how they work and how it's interpreting where you were aiming the ball and all that sort of stuff. So what it does is it makes the two other attackers, when you shoot, almost deliberately not run into the ball. In fact, quite often they'll turn around and they'll just run off. Because they'll think, he's taking the shot, I'm not needed then, I'll run back to the halfway line.
Doesn't that make you more likely to be offside? He said, knowing a thing about football.
No, well, if there's a defender further back, then it's not a problem. But very often, if they wouldn't be offside, they still don't run in and kick the ball or anything. They deliberately don't do that. And they never attack the ball. Like, you would close down a person who was attacking, who was on the ball, if you were a footballer and you were a defender, or you would attack a loose ball if you were the nearest person to it in real life. But they can't do that in this game, because it would result in lots of unsatisfying goals and scores that would be like 12-8, which would be unrealistic when they're trying to recreate, these.
Which is the real problem, that video games haven't managed to capture football, or that football hasn't managed to capture Speedball 2.
Speedball 2 is pretty good.
Yeah.
But have you tried to play it recently?
No.
It's kind of, doesn't really work as well as I remembered it, Danny.
I can just about cope with that, but if you told me that NHL 95 wasn't good to play it, I bought a Mega Drive and a copy of NHL 95 a few years ago just to play NHL 95 some more, and it's still great.
Sensible Soccer is still great, and I did buy an Xbox 360 specifically so I could play the remake of SWOS that they did, which was just SWOS, but it had an online mode, so you could play it over live. Mm-hmm. That was the thing that made me buy a 360.
Yeah, I have SWOS for 360. He's still the only game that my dad thinks accurately recreates football. So there you go. He would know. He's my dad.
It creates the spirit of football in a way that a lot of other football games don't. Like, there is a kind of
the platonic ideal of football, the way football feels in your head.
Yeah. Nothing platonic about some of those gifts.
I was trying to think about Plato and football, and being all caught up in his cloak.
All Greek philosophers to me look like Getafix from the Aztecs. Yeah. I imagine all of them.
My default is Mighty Aphrodite, Woody Allen's film. That's my default look for Greek philosophers.
I was going to say, because, I mean, I think of you, Graham, as a calm person, one of the calmest people I know, mostly because of your voice, but that's possibly because I haven't seen you play FIFA for about 13 to 14 months, which was the last time I saw you repeatedly and seriously angry. An arbitrary system that had denied you for no reason.
See, I've had proper actual real-life arguments with Graham over things that we were cross with each other for.
Mm.
So I've had a much more... I just wanted to bring up that I've had a much more genuine emotional contact.
Okay, well, that's great for you to bring that. I mean, what I'm saying is... Well, I like to think the Graham
rolls away.
Let's not fight for custody now.
No spilling your balls here.
We haven't fought since you came and worked for the side of good, have we?
No.
Well, then we don't live in the same house anymore.
What does that make like?
Probably. That's probably it. It.
And actually, you invoked the phrase side of good.
I did.
What does that mean?
Well, we're not. Future an evil corporation run by twisted CEOs
allegedly
but you murder babies, John.
I was only ever freelance. I was never employed by them. I pitied them with my words.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you and Marsh have fights?
Do you have trouble breathing on the high horse?
No, I find the air is so much cleaner up here. Actually.
Oh,
yeah, do you guys fight?
No, not really.
Oh,
passive aggressive emails, notes.
We've had moments, but only brief. Like
if we have any differences, we just cover ourselves in butter and wrestle, and
that's good.
And both of us win.
And so does the internet.
Yeah, everyone wins there.
Shall
we? I haven't spoken about my game.
I thought you didn't have a game.
I did say at the beginning of this. I did.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right.
Jesus Christ, Mark.
I just tune you out now, that's how we don't. That's how we avoid fighting.
It's really aggressive.
I was going to talk briefly about Shadowrun Returns.
Oh, yes, of course.
He did say that.
Yeah. He did totally say that.
It wasn't... we can find that. It doesn't sound like Dota 2. I don't know why I didn't hear it. Sorry, carry on.
Are you playing Dragonfall? Or the
I never played it. And I remember Marsh sort of recommending it and not really recommending it way back when. And I'm now playing it again, like from the first campaign they released onwards, for no particular reason, because they're not narratively connected. There are two campaigns, basically. I'm really enjoying it. It sounds like they've fixed a lot of the problems that Marsh had when he played it, like saving problems and things like that.
You don't have to talk about me in the third person throughout this.
Well, no, but you have to specify who you are for the benefit of an audience that will only receive this through an audio format.
All right. Stop, you know, making sense.
You mean this isn't being broadcast into all four quadraphonic speakers? They'd just be like, oh, that's coming out of the Marsh speaker. That is.
But anyway, so the save game system and things that you were upset about at the time are all fixed. Like, you can save anywhere, you can do anything like you can. And it's really good. And it's really good specifically as a lightweight RPG based on a pen and paper formula. Like, it's all really easily readable and it's easy to get into the game and create a character that is substantially customized to you, but who, it's very well paced, and you sort of very quickly move on with the story in a way that feels kind of engaging. Like, I've sort of set myself this task of playing a lot of the pen and paper derived RPGs that I've missed, partly because I want to generally, because it's a gap in my knowledge, and partly because I'm now writing pen and paper stuff and want to know more that other people have done for the same reason. And one of the things that's really struck me playing only, I would stress, the first hour and a half, I guess, of Shadowrun Returns, is how much extra freedom you can offer the player so that it still feels like amazing freedom compared to almost any other game, while still actually being way easier to write than writing for a live pen and paper audience. Yeah, yeah. And I figure this is something we've all got in common, because Marsh and Graham are doing my Numenera campaign, which we've had on hold for a while, but we'll get back this weekend, hopefully. And you guys are all doing Dungeons & Dragons at the moment.
We are, yes.
We killed some fucking trolls last
weekend. Oh my goodness. Last weekend.
We fucked those trolls up. Sorry, carry on.
But this is the thing, right?
We're going to fairies now.
Yeah, we're going to fucking sacrifice some fairies to the Star Child.
We'll see.
We're so fucking cool.
I'm not sure how my character feels about that.
But this is the thing. Again. Like, when you are writing for a live audience, you have to be ready for kind of like complete left of field dickbaggery. In a way that is welcome and good, but you have to kind of be ready for it in a way that doesn't feel cheap.
Welcome, dickbags.
Mm. To the extent that even like, even things that would be narrative contrivances in other medium, you don't want to do them because they feel like narrative contrivances. And that's especially hard, I think, when you're writing a pen and paper campaign for people who literally critique interactive narratives for a living. That is, it's like, oh, this feels like a contrivance. But in General Returns, it offers, like, a really good degree of freedom beyond what a game would normally offer you, the sort of the good, bad, and I want money trio of approaches to any given situation, into kind of extra things that are just specific enough to your character that feel kind of appropriate. So an example would be very early in the game, you're challenged to find a way upstairs and of a tenement building that's sort of taken over by Shadowrunners, this sort of like cyberpunk but with elves and dwarves kind of fantasy future thing. And there's this apartment building full of druggies and you go up to the penthouse. And one of the ways of doing it is to find a hole in the wall that you find by shoving a bookcase aside and then sneaking through to find a thing. But I believe there's like a penalty of some sort or like a kind of an alarm that's raised if you shove the bookcase. But my character happens to be a hacker. It just happens to be the class that I chose. And I happen to have a drone, which is like a little kind of Roomba with a machine gun strapped to it. a little robot that fights for me. And because I happen to have the little robot, rather than having to push the bookcase aside myself, it gave me the option of like shoving the robot through the hole and having it open the door from the other side. And that's only possible because that's kind of the very specific detail of how I built my character. And that's massively satisfying because it feels like the kind of thing that you would try and do in a real life pen and paper session where it's like, well, I have this, I can try this. Obviously, it's deterministic to some degree because the game developers had to go, well, this might be possible and I'll program it in this way. But it worked really well as a way of selling the kind of sense that you are specifically kind of involved.
Yeah, I think I talked my way up that tenement.
Yeah, I did that and then actually did it a different way in the end, which ended up, I managed to do it in a way that meant that when I got to the top floor, the enemies, the would-be enemies, weren't initially aggressive towards me, where they would have otherwise been had I not talked my way up.
Did you feed the dogs?
I gave them zebra meat, which made them go to sleep.
Yeah.
But that's, and that's really cool because it real like for me, it's like you need a little bit of that to go like, hey, my character creation decisions have been paid off now because even this part of the game, I'm already feeling like who I made is different to who anyone else would make.
So I spent all RPGs transfixed with fear that I've made all the wrong choices.
Mm.
So having something that kind of emboldens me in my choices, that sounds really good.
Mm. The other side of that is that there's some cases where the conversations, sometimes the conversation trees are very sprawling and you can go a million different directions and there are options that will be locked off to you if you don't pick them the first time you see them, which is sort of encouraging you to experiment. But sometimes you'll be given a way to respond to a character that is the same thing like three times. It's like, well, thanks for nothing, but in three different ways.
Hmm.
And at that moment, it's quite careful to give you, this is good, it's quite careful to give you three different ways of saying that. That subtly inform your, I don't know yet, I haven't played enough to know if it has an effect behind the scenes on how your character is regarded. But if, for example, I don't know, a detective who you've asked questions to has given you no useful information, you can be like, you weren't useful, but I respect you as a person. Or you can be like, well, fuck you then. Or, you know, well, thanks for nothing. And that, little choices like that, again, help to constantly reinforce who your character is or might be, and even if it's just to you.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is an argument I've tried to make before, and I'm surprised that it isn't just assumed. Like, when people will say, this happened with Mass Effect 3, actually, a great deal, where people will say, the choice I made didn't have a narrative consequence in the game. It's like, yes, it did, but you're the one who experienced it. You were nice. Exactly. You were nice in that moment, and therefore what happened in that moment is that you were nice. It doesn't matter that that person doesn't remember it in 3 hours' time. What matters is that you had the experience of being nice at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
And the idea that everything is about pushing a button that causes a thing to pop up.
Making a choice has meaning in itself, regardless of the consequences.
exactly. And it's really sad that people miss that.
It is the basis of the criticism of Mass Effect 3, the only game that I'm capable of going on about more than Dota 2.
I can do that too, because I remember defending the ending.
Yeah, I love the
ending.
And
being bemused by the fury. And then now I realise I just should keep my mouth shut because I can't be bothered dealing with angry, dumb people.
But the thing is, that, like, yes, the first thing is, making a decision has meaning in and of itself. Like, yeah. It is an action with meaning, regardless of consequence. The act of processing information and turning it into a choice, that is a thing that humans do, that is an action. It would cost action points if real life was a turn-based RPG. The second part of that is that you are ultimately, in these games, these single-player RPG campaigns, whatever form they take, whether it's Mass Effect or something like Shadowrun, which is more kind of traditional, you are performing the game to yourself. That is, you know, the story of the game is partly performed to you by you. Like, it is, yes, you rely heavily on the framework and the art and everything else provided by the game developer, but you are also fundamentally responsible in your own way for developing a story that makes sense to you with characters that you like.
Yeah, you have to meet the game halfway with any kind of fiction. You
exactly, and that,
spin around
that refusal
to say, why is the game so dumb? Let him spin around forever.
That is honestly why, like, but that is why people laugh at the phrase ludonarrative dissonance, and all our glasses are empty so we can't drink.
I
timed that really well. Because it's like, if you refuse to meet the game halfway and to be willing to tell yourself a story based on the things that you've decided that are going to be the case about your character or their attitude or whatever, then you really, you've sort of forgotten the right to complain if that story doesn't make any sense. It's the kind of like, well, I made Shepard with a pink mohawk and a big mustache and this game wasn't very immersive for me. Well, whose fault was that? Like,
did you find, because I forget the exact criticisms I leveled at the game before, but I have recollection that I found the combat in Shadowrun to be kind of just a bit fusty and static and not very exciting. At least initially, like in the first few hours, like it took a long time to get to the state where I felt I had a lot of options at my disposal.
So, to an extent, yes. Although
I wasn't playing a hacker though, so maybe that makes
sense. I mean, it's like I've got this cool robot. That's cool. Mm. It takes me an action point of my main character to switch it on at the beginning of fights, which is kind of an interesting little thing that I can activate a different character. Mm. Honestly, like
no XCOM.
It's no XCOM. Like, it's not a serious strategic like turn-based combat game. I love the game that got both of those things right: the kind of social stuff and the combat. One thing it taught me though is that, like, so personally, like, and you guys know this, like, in writing campaigns, or writing sessions for a pen and paper game, the single hardest thing to do beyond planning plot threads and dialogue and stuff for people to miss or uncover as they will, the single hardest thing to do is to plan how long combat is going to be.
Hmm.
Because knowing what the player characters are capable of is really hard, especially in a flexible system like Numenera, where it's much more kind of open-ended than something like Dungeons and Dragons. And as a result, we've had like combats that were pretty trivially easy for one or two characters, and combats that went on for having recently listened to a recording of our last session, a fight that went on for 2 hours, because
Marsh hid on a train somewhere and refused to participate.
Fuck you! I tried to run a pyromancer over. With a car.
It was pretty rad.
Didn't you run away from everyone to get in that car, and then when that didn't work, get in your car and just fuck off?
Yeah. Well, I was role-playing.
But nonetheless, like, that fight went on for fucking ages, and because it's really hard to balance exactly how long the combat would be. And so this might sound like a really shitty kind of cop-out praise of the game, but like, Shadowrun Returns, I'm playing on normal difficulty. All of its like fight sequences have been long enough to establish that my characters had a fight and are now low on health or have decent health or whatever, but not so long that it becomes the entire experience. Like, most of the game is talking to people and solving puzzles and doing things, and then occasionally a fight breaks out and it's a kind of pace change. I think that's probably the right ratio. Like, it's maybe that alone. Like, I'm playing these things partly to get useful feedback for things I could be doing in pen and paper, and that was one of them, was like, actually, fights should be probably quite brief, just to punctuate more interesting moments of interaction between characters. And
well, here's a question for you, though. I was thinking about the thing, like, the Mass Effect thing and stuff like that. So, obviously, a lot of what people were very angry about with the ending of Mass Effect 3 was that it didn't...
it didn't coincide with how where they saw the story going. It didn't make their decisions meaningful in the final moment. I was thinking, like, let's take some real life example. I'm married. The relationship I had with my wife was built up of a number of ways I behaved and decisions that we made, and you know, all these kind of RPG like decisions.
You had spoken to her repeatedly over a period of time.
I begged and begged and begged until she finally relented.
Started buying her gifts.
Yeah, that's right. And I said, I get, no, have 200 credits rather than just 100 and things like that. And
the Woohoo option appeared.
That's right. And so, but then we made all these decisions and now, you know, she's a few weeks away from giving birth to our first son. And as all these amazing things happen. None of that stops a car from running her over.
Oh, Jesus. Like, she could,
this is my point. God forbid it happened, but, you know, she could get hit by a car and then be dead. Now, all of the decisions and things I've planned to make up until this point don't have that narrative doesn't fit in, and yet that's
still exactly real what you mean, thoughts. Although that's the most horrible fucking example.
My saying isn't going to make it happen, thankfully, because I'm not a wizard. So it's just a hot, but I'm giving you a genuine example of something that horrendous that could happen and would dramatically change my entire life against all the decisions I made until this point.
Yeah.
Is that something that's reasonable for you to do as a GM? Is it something that's reasonable for a game to do?
I think it's something that, like, so I had this theory, I'm sorry for going on, but like, Mass Effect, over the whole course of the whole series, was about sort of escalating levels of responsibility, pretty much. Like, the beginning of the first Mass Effect game, you are a second-in-command on a ship, and you very quickly become the commander of that ship. And as your understanding of the galaxy and the problems facing it expand, your remit in terms of protecting that, you know, group of civilization, gets broader and broader and broader. And, like, people forget, for example, that the Reapers in Mass Effect weren't really revealed as the villains till quite close to the end.
Mm-hmm.
That initially Sovereign was just a ship, and Saren was the villain, and then you find out that Sovereign's actually the Reaper, and the whole thing does this kind of Lovecraft expansion, where it's like, it goes from being, oh, we're fighting this rogue spectre, to shit, ancient race of, you know, actually the galaxy's ended multiple times already.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that kind of, the, you know, it's the Mountains of Madness moment, like, Lovecraft does it all the time. Then Mass Effect 2 is about basically being space dad. Like, that game is about dad issues. It just is. Every single subplot in that game is about dads. They're all about dads. Look at any companion's backstory in that game and their companion mission. Just dad's the game.
Dad's in space!
It is. Dad's in space the game. And it's because Shepard is now his commander and he's kind of settled in that role. Mass Effect 3 is pretty much about, like, sort of like quasi divinity, like Shepard kind of going beyond the point where he's solving galactic conflicts.
That she's solving galactic.
Yeah.
She.
conflicts that have gone on for so long and been so sort of deep rooted that they're kind of impossible to solve, and just repeatedly solving one after the other after the other. And then if you see it like that, the last decision in that game makes complete sense, because it's like, well, actually, you've assumed this much responsibility now. Like, you are literally capable of making the biggest decisions anyone has ever made. So make the biggest decision. And it makes complete sense thematically. Like, but it is that kind of like, shit, guess what? The small things you did don't matter anymore.
Yeah.
Because you've just been hit by the bus marked, you're now space god.
I agree. And that's why I thought the ending was brilliant.
Yeah.
I think it was, could have been done better.
It's a gut punch. Like
Ghost Boy was probably the weakness, but the storyline.
It sounds like Mass Effect kind of justifies it over this 3-game arc, but I kind of wish that, because most games, the ending, when it doesn't tie in to what's come before, it's just a single game. And that I kind of wish it did. Like,
the ending
Deus Ex Human Revolution, my favourite choice in that is the one early on, and I'm always bringing that up to praise it, because I want to buy it back from the meme that kind of ruined it. But when you get back from the first mission and Malik says, how do your wicked cool robo arms feel, Jay, you know, Jensen? And you can say,
Jensen.
I didn't ask for this. But, you know, I think that choice embodied me in that role and made everything that came afterwards feel personal and feel like I was playing a part. But then the end of it is, which of the four buttons do you want to press in order to decide
the universe?
It doesn't earn it in that same way. And so I would
do you mean the original Deus Ex?
No, I'm talking about Human Revolution.
Because the original Deus Ex ends up with four buttons.
It's a really common thing in games. I'm using Human Revolution as an example, but games do it all the time. And it sounds like Mass Effect kind of justifies that over a 3-game arc.
It does.
I wish most games had a much smaller scale.
The extended cut helps that a little bit. Like, it gives, like, the endings in the extended cut are really good. Like, and also the Leviathan, one of the expansions, little mini expansions, gives you extra questions to ask at the end, which help to kind of flesh out exactly why things are happening in a way that's quite good. I mean, I, but I like, I finished Mass Effect 3 like the weekend it came out, because it was easily my most anticipated game of all time. I've never been more excited for a game than I was for that. And the next day I flew to LA for a press trip. And over the course of that 12-hour flight, I think the rest of the internet finished the game and expressed their opinions on it. So I finished it and spent like a flight and literally sealed in a metal tube, yeah, thinking about how much I liked the ending, how much of a gut punch it was in some ways, but how kind of right it felt. And how I was so worried that they would cop out and do a happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
Like how I, you know, I was so kind of afraid of these things when I've been looking forward to the game that I was like, I'm sad, but I'm satisfied. And then like had this complicated relationship with them, but I was ultimately satisfied. And then I got off the plane and the internet was literally like writing petitions because it was so awful. And it was like,
I reviewed it in isolation. I didn't know the ending. I wrote how much I love the ending in my review because I loved the ending.
Mm.
And then I wrote a piece. I just began to hear the first rumours of people complaining. So I wrote a piece about saying why I think the ending's a really good decision and arguing for it. All this just before it really kicked off. And so I had
it was
no idea
extraordinary.
But it was going to be the most unforgivable opinion I'd ever had.
You asked, is it okay for a game to do the thing of killing your wife?
Yeah.
after a long
time. It's not okay.
It's not okay for a game to kill my wife. I'm going to stress that now. I'm not cool with it.
I think it's okay for a game to do it, but I wouldn't necessarily enjoy it, and I may be cross about it on the internet if a game made me go grief after.
This is the fucking
whereas,
thing.
Like, but
I think I'd be delighted if a game did it.
If a game did it sometimes, I suppose, I would be all right with it. But I would much rather...
Oh, like every game did it.
I would prefer... I mean, this is one of the reasons I would like shorter games, because I would like games where you could do that stuff in a short experience, where I hadn't invested not just 90 hours, but how many years between Mass Effect sequels?
5 over time.
Okay, so people have invested 5 years of enthusiasm into this thing. That's a pretty long time, and yeah, of course some people are going to get angry about it.
Here's the thing, you can not like an ending and go... Okay, I didn't like that ending. That's an available option. Or you can go, wow, I wasn't expecting that ending. I'll think about why it happened. There's so many different ways you can react to it that aren't threatening the life of the person who knows the person who wrote it.
Yeah, of course that's terrible.
Like, I mean, the other thing about it is, like, I think games have to be free to give you bad news sometimes. Like, it can't be just that your effort has translated into perfect victory. Congratulations, well done, go home. Like,
I like more sad endings. I like more ambiguous endings. I don't need everything to be wrapped up.
This is one of the reasons that I think that like Dragon Age 2 suffered so much. Like, because that game has problems. Like, it has real visible problems with the amount of art that it has for environments. Like,
well, the main problem it has to do was meant to be an expansion pack, and then it went shit. We need to make a game.
But narratively, it's among BioWare's best recent games. It's got one of its best written group of companions, Miles. And it's the first time they've really significantly experimented with the structure of their games in a way that's genuinely interesting, because it's novelistic rather than epic, basically, in its layout. Like, it is not a single narrative stretched out over 70 hours. It is three discrete narratives in the life of one person that kind of together form a whole, but you have to be paying attention the entire time. And that completely kind of failed for them in a way that is really sad, because they should be encouraged to experiment with their format.
I agree to an extent. I thought Dragon Age 2 was a good RPG, but it unfortunately came after Dragon Age, which meant, you know, it was just... Dragon Age was an extraordinary RPG. And so being good in that shadow was never going to give them a good head start.
I totally agree with that, but I kind of, like, I think when I'd realised that this was a downscaled version of this thing that I loved, I appreciated the degree to which they were willing to tinker with the formula. Like, Dragon Age Origins is amazing, but it is also a BioWare game where you must collect three different things from three different parts of the world before bringing them together in the fourth final part of the world. Which, like, every other fucking BioWare game ever. Whereas Dragon Age 2 feels like... It is like the kind of... That moment in, like, a comic book or something where the kind of... where someone with a completely different take on the world gets a hold on the setting and just tells you something completely different with it. Like, it has that... really focused look at a particular group of people and how, like, information travels in a world is kind of interesting in Dragon Age 2. Like, it's about a group of... It's the only BioWare game that actually makes a point of the whole companion idea. Like, the notion of Dragon Age 2, the sort of narrative structure, is that one of your former companions is being interrogated to find out basically how some sort of unnamed revolutionary disaster has occurred. And the person interrogating them won't believe that there wasn't a conspiracy in place to kind of link these kind of disparate people who came together at a crucial moment in the world's history. But what the actual story of the game tells you is that it was an accident. And that these people came together by accident, just through natural kind of affiliations and affections and things like that. And they had all these complicated relationships with each other. But to the outside world, it looks like this revolutionary cell forming through conspiracy, which is a much more interesting kind of like take on how information works and how narrative can form and be wrong. Like, it allows them to do weird things with like an unreliable narrator, where when the guy being interrogated comes to tell his own story, he tells it completely wrong the first time. The game makes you redo it because he makes himself look like the hero. Like, stuff like that they've never done since. Like, that kind of like weird experimentation with
Call of Juarez Gunslinger does, though.
Mm. Call of Juarez.
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 Call of Juarez. So I'm fluent in Mexican.
So, Jesus Christ. Allegedly. But yeah, no. Sorry, massively off topic there. But
do you guys take a break at any point? Because I'm going to burst urine all over the room.
Not really. At exactly this point. That's where we take a break.
It's good. See you in a minute, guys.
Bye.
Bye. And we're back.
Hi, everybody.
What an undetectable break.
I know. Our balls have been spilled and we're hot and ready for questions from questions.
Yes, we are. Dan Needham writes, Dear Creating Crowbar Music Factory.
Nice.
Will Creating Crowbar be getting a Steam curator page? And if so, which games immediately spring to mind for inclusion? Will it just feature a single detective-themed grappling hook / face-punching simulator? Sincerely, Dan.
We do have a creation page. We don't need a
creation page.
Some of those.
And a creation page. John's the only one not drinking.
Yeah, we have a creation page. There's some games on it. We shall link it in the show notes. We don't include Gunpoint because we think that'll probably be some kind of conflict of interest. We're not really sure.
I'm sure we've got Sir You're Being Hunted in ours, haven't we? Surely we have.
Oh, gosh.
Well, actually.
Oh, boy.
Hello, is that Gamergate? Yeah. I've just got some interesting news.
Surely it's not a conflict of interest for us to put Gunpoint. Surely it's, like, Tom's sole interest. It's just that.
I think
which is free.
I think if you're recommending that game alongside other games that you have no stake in, then you have to flag it up in some way.
But I think we could just have the note be, Tom made this, and then...
Yeah.
Do as you will. Like, there is a demo available, at the very least.
Otherwise.
But yeah, God knows. I mean, if you want to use this as a barometer for ethics in the games industry, it's as good as any other one.
I've got loads of ethics.
You got ethics?
I've got a bag of them.
You've been farming them for years.
Yeah, I've got at least 50 ethics.
Like Saruman, kind of nurturing the hordes of Uruk-hai.
Yes.
Your little kind of ethics that pop out of horrible sacks.
You love this metaphor.
Wriggling,
but it gets away from you. It just slips your fingers like sand.
Andrew Ferguson writes, Chris.
Oh, God, no.
You're in trouble. I've just listened to episode 60, and it's literally the first time I've ever felt like turning off the podcast since episode 1. What was wrong with episode 1?
Yeah.
The Delta talk is shoehorned into every question to the point that it's draining.
Okay.
At one point, you stated you were answering a question because it lends itself to discussion, quotes.
That is why we would answer it.
Which was less a discussion and more you talking about Dota casting and plugging your Dota guild and Dota. He goes on for a couple of more paragraphs. And there's a good question at the end, which is unrelated. But
okay.
I'll read the question, but
can I respond to that?
Yeah.
I mean, Chris is a prick. but to be honest, I don't think anybody's going to be angry about the most amount of Dota that's spoken about. It should be me. Like, I have to put up with this sometimes before I've had coffee. Sometimes Chris bursts into my room when I'm having my special private times and tells me about fucking Slark. You know?
You love it.
I wasn't angry about episode 60, so you can't be.
I thought you can't have your special private times without being told.
True.
Look, I think I would always have assumed that the only thing more wearying than me constantly talking about Dota would be me constantly apologising for talking about Dota and then talking about Dota.
We've got a great Dota question later.
We do, actually.
Look forward to that.
So there's two sides of this. The serious side of this is, actually, I think it is of interest to a substantial number of people listening to the podcast based on the feedback received on the forums. If that's wrong, this is part of that. Graham's silly voice aside, take that on board. The other side of it is that, honestly, it's a really interesting game that has a shitload to say about how communities form and about how game design works and how competitive games work and and all these other things. Like, I wouldn't be interested in it. It's a chicken and egg thing. Like, I wouldn't have this abiding interest in it if it wasn't somehow actually applicable to a shitload of questions you might raise about game design.
Was this guy's name? What's his name?
Andrew.
Andrew. I suggest that Andrew find a local charity and volunteer just a couple of hours a week and just help out there.
that's a good recommendation.
But I'd be sorry if anyone felt alienated from the podcast if I spoke about it. I felt the same way when people wouldn't stop fucking talking about Spelunky.
How long ago was that?
A long time ago, but that's because Spelunky faded, but Dota is forever.
In fairness to Andrew, he also says...
And we've always been at war with Eurasia.
Fairness to Andrew, he also says... I'm sorry this is coming across more negative than I'd hoped. I really love this podcast. It is easily my favorite. I try to get all my friends on it.
Yeah, okay.
And then he adds, better add a question too. I love the idea of 4X strategies, and I'm always buying them and failing to get over the learning curve. What is the best way to break through and get Crusader Kings? YouTube videos, brute force, sacrifice the weekend to study. Is there a game you tried to get into but couldn't for a long time? I'm going to ignore the last part of that and focus on Crusader Kings and how you get into it.
You just don't. 4X games are really boring.
4X games are brilliant. I'm not a huge Civ fan, but 4X games are often great.
It's basically shopping in space.
And Crusader Kings is a soap opera about medieval bastards, literal bastards, scheming and plotting.
Well, their mummy and daddy weren't married when they were born.
Yes, and that you get a trait, or you get a bastard trait.
Wow, awesome.
Because if you're talking about, you know, Middle Ages, that's an important thing when you're trying to gain power and spread and stuff like that. And Crusader Kings is great because it's a soap opera. There's a great Game of Thrones mod, but even if you're playing just vanilla, it is the 4X games of The Sims with all the same dramas and cheating and backstabbing and all that sort of stuff, which is really fun. The way I got into it was two things. One, which was, because it is a soap opera, failing in it is really fun. The joy in it isn't winning and conquering the world, which you're unlikely to ever do, because you can start off as a king, but you can also start off as just the ruler of a small county and then try to grow your influence from there. Most cases, you're probably going to be sent to prison, you know, because one of your plots got discovered, and then maybe you'll take over your kids, but if not, it's just game over. But failing is really fun. You get great anecdotes of it. So relax, first of all. The second thing I would do is I would choose a very small, closed-off part of the world to work within. I started with Iceland, which I think has 2 or 3 provinces, which means you don't have to worry about a lot of the larger-scale machinations that are going on if you start, you know, in the middle of Belgium or in the UK somewhere. And you just get quite core, little, small, in a bottle drama, basically, about trying to take over Iceland when you're not the king of it yet, you're just the ruler of one little province, naturally.
What year is this all set in?
It's the Middle Ages. I don't know what the starting year 15? Is, but it can cover, because you have, part of it is finding a wife and having kids, and then when you die, you become your kid, so it happens over generations of a couple of hundred years, like 1400 to 1600 kind of time.
So if you're in Iceland, go north to Ayakuri, visit the Godafoss Falls.
Okay,
it's really good. They wouldn't be called that until around the 10th century. So, when king of Denmark threw their idols into the waterfall to say that they were now a Christian country, because that's how you become Christians, by someone just besmirching your current religion in a really rude way. That always works.
Wasn't Iceland founded by someone like fleeing from other Scandinavian countries because of religious persecution and just landing on Iceland and being like, well, this is the end of the earth because it's all just volcanic rock. And within like 30 years, they'd cut down all the trees that were there because it was mostly volcanic rock and not that much growth, which is why it's a country that's only recently been able to grow its own vegetables.
It's really lovely. Don't bother with Reykjavik, though.
Ooh. I like Reykjavik.
It's just a town with all the same shops as every other town.
I was really
disappointed by Reykjavik. It's beautiful, though.
I really like Reykjavik. It's really fun, kind of much more bohemian than you expect it to be, given that it's a little island up so far north. And also, it's great for all the excursions you can do out from there to the geysers and various waterfalls and
that
blue water springs. Yeah,
yeah.
Blue again. Which I didn't go to.
How did we end up reviewing Iceland?
This is the Lonely Planet podcast.
I'm really disappointed. My job is to go on other people's podcasts and then divert them way off subject for as long as I can. And the entire first half of this podcast, I forgot to do that.
When you said that metaphor, it slipped through my fingers. I should have said it was like the One Ring falling off Isildur's hand. But I didn't.
I'm so glad that you did.
Imagine if you had.
What a great podcast this would have been.
I've done monster trucking in Iceland, pretty much. Paid for by the Icelandic Tourist Board. If you want to know about my corruption.
Yeah.
I'm biased to Iceland. because it was when I first went there, the first time around, it was shortly after the volcano, and they were just desperate for tourism to come back. Mm. And so a bunch of game journalists coming there, the Icelandic Tourist Board paid for those journalists to have a day out. And one of the things they did was put us on giant off-road monster trucks and drive us around the rivers and stuff.
The Icelandic Tourist Board make the best tourism videos of the whole world. They're amazing.
They are really great.
Really,
actually.
Really good.
I think I've told this story on the podcast before as well about being birthed by planet Earth. because one of the things we did on this trip was
you shouldn't be confusing this with our D&D campaign.
We went lava caving, which was like a cave didn't have lava in it, but it had been recently carved by lava, and so stone walls mostly covered in ice. And we hadn't really been explained what this day trip was going to be like, and so we were all just wearing regular clothes. And then it was like, okay, here's some hard hats, here with lights on the front, here's some shoes. And then, like, an hour later, you're crawling on your belly through spaces so small that you can't stand up and wishing you weren't wearing your nice kilt. Well, other people who had claustrophobia had gone back and not gone this way. But at the end of it, after, like, crawling through and having these great experiences where, like, they told everyone to turn off the lights on their helmet and you just sat 30 feet under the ground in complete pitch darkness. It was really weird and still. But at the end of it, as you came through this tunnel, the exit from the cave was perfectly vertical. And so you kind of just pulled yourself up and climbed up and raised up. And Iceland is, except for the bits that are volcanoes, very flat. So you just kind of pop your head out of the ground and you can just see for miles of like snow stretching off to mountains in the distance. And it's like, pop! Popping out. It was really incredible. So
and that's how you get into Crusader Kings.
This is true. That's my advice, Andrew. Andrew, a hater of Dota.
Anyone else got a game that they didn't think they could ever get into?
I think that's a good question.
Because I was going to say, like, I never really thought I'd enjoy isometrics, team-based strategy. Until I played StarCraft 2. No, I'm joking. I'm not going to even touch this one with the Wipeout.
I don't think I never thought I was going to get into anything like these exploring games like Minecraft and stuff. You ever heard of Minecraft?
No.
It's a game about cubes. Okay. I resisted Minecraft for the longest time, and then now I just adore all these free open world explorer-y, create your own story, adventure-y things. I love them now. And I just hid from them for the longest time.
Yeah, they're pretty intimidating.
Yes, they are. That's what interesting I was going to say about Ethan Carter. One of the things I found about it was it just underlined for me how desperately much I want games to be linear if they're not open world. So if they're open world and I can go in any direction, do anything, that's wonderful. But if they're not, just keep me on the path. Because the main problem with Ethan Carter is you can go quite a long way off the path before you hit the invisible wall.
Mm.
And then you think, oh, am I missing? So if I don't, just point me in the right direction. This is too much freedom. I don't like it. I think I'm like agoraphobic and can't cope. Mm. That's the problem I have with Stalker. I can never get into... There's another game. Really? I can never get into Stalker because the game started and every direction seemed to be the right direction.
That's true, actually.
And I was paralysed and couldn't go in any of them.
Yeah, but if you go in any direction, you do find interesting stuff, which is unlike... You
traditionally get eaten by a dog.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was my Stalker experience.
I found Stalker more satisfying when I was going to sound like heresy, stuck to the critical path a bit and just sort of played it like a...
I think that's definitely the way to get into it.
Like, I think played it like a... Like a linear shooter, but with interesting lateral freedom occasionally in terms of how you approached individual combat encounters. Because otherwise...
I never played anything quite like it before, so you didn't know what the boundaries of it were, and you're being punished for kind of pushing at them, I think, because you just don't know what's lethal and what's not. But if you kind of stick to the path, you get a sense of where you can explore.
If you want to talk about moralistic endings to games, that game that deserves an award for just dicking you over right at the end for no apparent reason.
Yep.
But in a way that's kind of brilliant because it suits the source matter completely, which is that you've sort of crawled through this wilderness for however many hours it's taking you to finish it, 10 hours or whatever, and you get to the end, it's just like, guess what, mate? Moral fable about how you've chosen to play it. Fuck you.
You can, in fact, see a complete video series of me getting into a game which I did not think I could get into if you go to our YouTube channel, which is me playing Dark Souls with Bruce Stanton.
And
now I'm so fucking into it, I'd probably get a Dark Souls tattoo if I was the kind of person who'd get a tattoo.
It's
I get it on my perineum as well.
It's sort of telling that, you know, your disdain is so easily overcome by someone else's enthusiasm. Like, do you not...
Yeah, still waiting for that to happen with Dota, but, you know...
You enjoyed that cast,
I did. I did like it.
Also on our YouTube channel.
I don't like games where other people are involved. That's my problem with Dota.
Let's not talk about that because people have told me off.
You should probably do another one of your lovely questions. Since you get questions to your podcast, my bloody podcast.
What's your podcast called, John?
It's called The Rock, Paper, Shotgun Podcast.
The weekly rock paper shotgun
electronic wireless show was called at one point.
Yes, I remember listening to that when I was merely a boy,
a wee laddie.
I discovered Minecraft.
Yes, you did, didn't you,
Jamie Adams?
He was in Notch's mum's basement rooting around.
I'm solely responsible for his success.
They call him $2.5 billion.
Also, FTL. I'm going to read this
question. My great success is hex cells. that's how we're coming to switch the world back to
it's
the best bloody puzzle game in 10 years and not a single other website or magazine has
reviewed it. Can I ask you about hex cells?
Sickens
because I've been tempted to download it just looks like Minecraft.
I promise it plays nothing like Minecraft.
Why is it different from Minecraft? Because I was genuinely looking at it.
Have you ever played Have you ever played Slitherlink?
Yes!
That's a much better comparison. Doesn't play anything like Slitherlink, but it's the same sense of that you have to figure out more and more rules to be able to continue to find the correct route through a puzzle and get your way there. Minecraft is, of course, just
it's not Minecraft. Minesweeper. Isn't
it funny how we're both talking about Minesweeper?
I was like, is this a joke?
We were both definitely talking about Minesweeper.
I decided to gloss over that temporarily about Dota.
So yes, it plays. Minesweeper is a horrible, shitty game of no reward or skill. It's just pure luck and badly designed.
God, the Minesweeper form is going to be furious.
It's a complete. Just the fact that you're identifying the number of cells around a cell by the number in it is the only thing it has in common. The rest of it is just these intricate rules that you have to learn just by as you play. And as you progress, he introduces more rules. Hex Cells Plus is a wonderfully superior game to the original Hex Cells, which is already amazing. And then Hex Cells Infinite is a kind of wonderful bow tied to the top of just saying, okay, you've learned how to play Hex Cells. Now try some really bloody difficult combinations of it. The guy's an absolute genius to create puzzles that.
I will download that game from the Steam that they have
but
nowadays.
It drives not a single other website or game. You'd think that people would like look on Rock Paper Shotgun and go, oh, these guys really, really like this game. Should we give it a look?
It's because it looks so much like Minesweeper, but with the gimmick of having different shaped boxes. That's why. I mean, you know, it's because people are judging it based on.
You know those competitive Minesweeper, right? That people should actually compete and have tournaments around the world.
I was younger and I would play Minesweeper, I would in my head pretend I was part of a tournament as I was playing.
You should speak to Matt Castle about Minesweeper. He's a massive Minesweeper fan, has lots of very interesting
things. But it's a random game where there's no correct route through the game and you can be forced to lose. It's just pure guesswork about clicking where you click.
No, it's not.
It 100% is. There are points where you cannot make a deduce a next move.
That can happen, but otherwise
and then you have to just
pure
click.
Deduction.
Yeah, but that happens almost every, if you're playing on expert, every single game, you will reach a point where you can't deduce a new move and you just have to click randomly and hope you don't hit a mine. What? That's awful design!
Well, I mean, I can argue against the random thing, first of all, because you're probably playing the Windows version of Minesweeper, which actually has a limited number of designed boards, because the competitive Minesweeper scene is based around completing boards as fast as possible, and so what they do is they memorize boards by rote. So they see a board, they make two clicks, and then, oh, I know what board this is, done in 3 seconds, and set world records based on this, and this is what the competition is based on. And then because of the frustration with the Minesweeper that came with, I think, like 95, 98, and 2000, which only had like 100 boards,
oh, really?
Out, they created their own version of Minesweeper, which had thousands of boards. And proper timing and stuff like that built into it so they could use that for competitive Minesweeper and recording these records. And so it's definitely not random, because it's, there are just a preset number of
No, I don't mean random in that sense. I mean random in the sense that you have to guess. And that's the worst puzzle design. That's terrible puzzle design. You go, I'm going to go and get Nikolai on your podcast, and he will shout and rant at you and tell you why that's terrible puzzle design. In Japanese.
So, dear Andrew from earlier, I am sorry. I genuinely am. Like, I don't want anyone to feel alienated from this podcast by the fact that I like Dota. But, aren't you glad right now you're really into competitive Minesweeper?
There's a brilliant article. Share that? There's a brilliant article about competitive Minesweeper written by Laura Michet. I'm probably mispronouncing that. M-I-C-H-E-T. Is a fantastic game journalist who doesn't write much anymore. But if you Google for it, or we'll link it in the show notes. It's brilliant.
Free Cell is a way better game.
My dad likes Free Cell.
My friend Greg's dad decided to play Free Cell from game 00001. All the way through in his lifetime. I don't know how far he's got now.
I think
that he's got a PC. Well, he certainly did a few years ago. A PC that still has Windows 98 on it, I think, in order that they won't lose his Free Cell progress.
How many levels are there?
I think there's 10,000. Well. No, 99,000. 900,000.
After he exhausted the delights of Mahjong. Yeah, and he went on to...
I think the kind of obsessive completion of a fundamentally uncompletable game is a dad thing. My dad's trying to complete Bejeweled. I bought him Bejeweled 3 for Christmas like 2 years ago, and this is actually an old story now because he's since I think stopped
playing. He's on Bejeweled 20.
He's playing it on the infinite Zen mode.
No, but like this is the most amazing thing, because like not a gamer. I hate that phrase, but like not a gamer. But he
hashtag
yeah hashtag. He would. Start, like, so, like, I think Bejeweled 3 on its main menu, and this is probably an interesting lesson in how important every single design decision you ever make in a game is important. Bejeweled 3's main menu is a grid, starting in the top left and kind of working down through multiple modes. So, as far as my dad was concerned, the game was getting the maximum possible achievement and finishing all of the achievements on every mode before progressing to the next mode,
wow,
left to right along the grid. And he got, like, most of the way down the grid, like, having gotten every single achievement for Classic Mode, single kind of possible high score and you know, done every kind of impossible combo of hyper gems and whatever. And I remember going home like 7-8 months after I'd bought it for him and looking at his time played, and it was like 72 hours or something. And it's like, holy shit. Like, there is nothing casual about this.
Whatever you do,
it's very dad.
Whatever you do, do not introduce him to Candy Crush, or you will have no inheritance.
Well, yeah.
I don't think he'd like Mass Effect 2, game about dads.
I don't think so, but I think that's
Commander Dad.
It's not really completable in the same way.
See, my dad never completes games because he obsessively worries about decisions he's made earlier on. Mm. So, like, my dad's never seen Alpha Centauri in Civilization, because he'll get to like 1500 and then go, oh, I could have done something better at 500 BC, and he'll reload and go back and just do it again. And he just obsessively, and he'll finish any RPG with 8 trillion potions every single time, because he's just so worried about every decision.
And one day he will perfect history.
He will. It's true. It's gonna be amazing.
I'm going to read this question because it's kind of poetic given the last 20 minutes. But Jimmy Adams writes, why don't you get drunk as much? Your semi-swearing was endearing, and you gave an excuse for not pronouncing names right. Marsh, say curation again.
Wow.
Narrative dissonance, he yells at the end of his emails. Repetitions omitted to save ink.
That was
Jamie.
I think we had a run where we weren't drinking very much.
I mean, there was a point. There was a turning point. There was a tipping point. A literal tipping point. All over someone's laptop.
Yeah. I was very ill, not only as a result of that evening, but for the ensuing 6 months, possibly as a result of my excessive alcohol consumption. Who would know?
I was wondering whether it was
better now.
And you're grown-ups now, and you don't need to get drunk all the time.
No, you're wrong about that.
No.
Like, it's become a... I mean, well, to reassure Jamie, it has been a tradition of the podcast. There are three roles in the podcast. Mm. There's host, booze lord, and question lord.
And editor.
Editor, but yeah, I suppose. But that's true. There are four. he says, the person who's editing. And, yeah, no, it's, we've always drunk, I think. We've had very few completely boozeless podcasts.
Mm. Mm. It has been later the last 6 months.
It has.
I think you've just got to learn to love yourselves and who you really are and not depend on alcohol to get through this.
But it is very funny, John. How do you contend with that?
I just think, again, it's like those, it's like comedians say how they rely on the heroines to be funny. It's, no, the funniness is in your heart, not your magic drugs.
All right.
Seymour writes.
Also, I'm driving, so I can't have any delicious rum that you're all having.
Dear Creighton Crowbar, whenever anyone is asked to defend games or present their benefits to the wider public, the first or second reason will almost always be related to health or cognitive benefits, improved processing speed, or visual spatial skills. I attach a link to a study that suggests that games do not provide strong measurable benefits in this way, which we'll include in the show notes. So, team, number one. Why do people feel the need to mention such benefits to the public first and foremost when they are not the first reason that people play games? And two, if the team were to be asked, what's the benefit of games? Why play them? By a respected broadcast journalist or live TV or their grandparents, whoever is less knowledgeable about games, what would their response be? Thanks for the podcast, Seymour.
Can I have a go at that? Even though I'm just your mere guest.
Number one or number two?
A special guest.
Number one.
Not a mere guest.
Oh.
If we had Alec Mir on, that'd be a mere guess. That's a good joke! And his surname's Mir.
Oh, God!
Yeah. Oh, a double joke. A rare instance of a double joke.
Ha, ha, ha. Yeah, so the first part. This is true. Well, why do people say it? It's obvious because games are constantly lamented by the mainstream press as the source of all evil because it's the latest technology, as is always the case. Video nasties, 80s, films, books. Books were literally heralded as the end of mankind and
tea.
Destroying the
tea
youth.
Tea at one point was considered to be causing women to have loose morals. And the health warnings in newspapers suggested women drink gin instead.
Society.
Sorry.
No, but there's a good... Exactly. So that's... So in order to defend that, you want to kind of counter that argument. You want to go, well, actually, no, there are... I think we need to stop doing that. I really do. So every now and then a study will come out saying yes. And there are very strong studies showing that if you regularly play these types of games, your reflexes improve, which is good for if you're a fighter pilot, but you're not a fighter pilot. So...
Shut up, John. The dream isn't dead.
So that's probably not a really strong argument in favour of why you're playing video games.
I can cast spells really quickly.
I think as long as you're defending them, you're creating the impression they need to be defended.
Yeah.
And maybe we all just need to just tell people to stop being such silly old duffers and just get on with it.
I wrote...
Punch them once squarely in the nose and move on.
Yes.
Is this your advice to parents? Your grandparents.
No,
stop being a silly old duffer, you say, as you punch them in the face.
My nan's totally on board with this.
What, being punched in the face?
No, my gaming.
Oh, I see, right.
It's fine.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. All my grandparents are dead, so fuck them.
She's my only surviving one, and she's fine.
Right, so mine are dead as well.
Yeah.
That's depressing.
Sorry about that.
We published an article in RPS yesterday that I wrote about why the BBC should get involved in video games, and one of the reasons that I think they should is that it would move us past this debate. Part of the reason that this persists is because there is an impression that if games aren't harmful to you, then they are at least frivolous toys. And any time the mainstream media engages with them in ways which aren't ban the sick filth, it's still treating them as products. It's talking about them as things that you buy. And as evidenced, Marsh, you were talking recently about how Radio 3 covered Destiny, but only within the...
That was front row. Did you hear the same front
row? Yeah, I thought that was actually pretty good.
I was really surprised how good it was.
But they did it under the context or because of the claim that Destiny was the most expensive game of all time. And that's treating games as products. Whereas what public service broadcasting is better at is exploring the ideas behind things.
Yeah.
And the example I give in the article is, for example, Jonathan Meads talking about architecture. And he can do a full half-hour episode about caravans and talk about caravans as ideas and what they mean within society.
With a stump of an arm.
And I'd love for there to be someone doing the same thing for games, treating them as collections of ideas. And by doing that and treating them on that level, you raise the level of debate past the point at which people can just dismiss them as nasty products.
But here's the thing, here's the secret about games. They are trivial. They are trivial.
Sometimes, but not always.
But mostly... But we've got to stop being silly about this.
No, but like,
caravans are trivial. Like,
yeah, they
are.
Most books are trivial. But books are wonderful.
But you can take trivial things and talk about them in a serious way,
absolutely.
Which is very interesting, and take things which are normal and taken for granted and make them strange and unusual, and in so doing, make you think about things that you would never normally think about and be very insightful. And that's what I want. So it's not saying that games aren't trivial, it's just treating games as ideas.
I'm really interested in the way that our sense of what is and isn't trivial stems from our sense of what does and doesn't have an author. Because games, I think, struggle in the public eye because they very rarely have a singular author. Mm. Indie games are an exception to this, but most games are kind of unique in almost all forms of public media in that they stem from a group of people without a clear director, single lead designer kind of. There are exceptions to that, obviously, but actually often those exceptions are misleading.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about the product of a single person, you're actually talking about the product of multiple people. They are fundamentally collective works. And as a result, they often express rather muddied or watered down ideas when it comes to individual direction, right? That's one of the weaknesses of games as a medium, I would say. But I think it, more than that, it massively hampers the way that they're discussed. And as a result, we kind of dismiss them as trivial when what they actually are are representative of kind of like broad public taste. And that is evidenced by the fact that they are by far and away the most popular and lucrative form of entertainment on the planet. And as a result, like, I don't know. I think for me, the weakness of the inability for traditional forms of broadcast media to latch onto games and find something to talk about them speaks more to a dependency on concepts of authorship than it does on actually
the weaknesses. I don't know if I agree with you. I think you're right in that the game's muddy authorship means that they are more composite things and so difficult to hammer down into a single kind of meaning.
Mm.
So it's difficult to kind of draw parallels with, I don't know, a play that obviously has a particular agenda. But I don't think that would stop people talking about it on Radio 4. I think what stops people talking about Radio 4 is that they don't have the articulacy with games to recognise the comparison points between that and the other things that they're discussing in the programme. I mean, I actually had a little Twitter exchange with the person who hosts Saturday Review, actually, that reviewed it, which is a great, one of the great kind of cultural review programmes available, and everybody should listen to it. But he said, mea culpa, you know, obviously we do talk about these games only when they become the biggest selling because it's very difficult for us to find a way in, you know.
Mm-hmm. But that's the naivety is of the guests that they're choosing. So they choose people who are very au fait with the theatre and books and stuff, obviously, because that's what they're mostly talking about on that programme. But then when they come to the video games, and that was the best I've ever heard. Ever.
Because they totally went, we don't know what the fuck we're talking about.
But your son said it was very good. Exactly. It was still, my son thought this, well, my daughter thought this, well, found that I couldn't. And that,
I found
there
that
are people who play video games who also know, who also
know,
read books
and go
to the theater.
They have access to those exact people. They have, even amongst the people who commonly appear on that program, people like Helen Lewis and Naomi Oldman, know Games Inside Out. They would have easily been able to opine quite sophisticatedly about that game. Obviously, I don't know if they just missed it that week. I was surprised at the level of open-mindedness that a lot of the
really
guests
pleased.
Had about that game.
Even saying that thing about authorship does not preclude the existence of open-mindedness towards the medium. I feel like you can't
interview the director or the lead actor.
And you can't talk about intent in the same way that makes something casually easy to explain.
Mm.
And that's sort of... And that's a problem with, like, trying to integrate, like, games media, which has gotten used to, for all its faults, dealing with that over time, and talking about how games work, with traditional media. Like, that's one of the kind of points where the sockets don't quite mesh, is that, where it's like, actually, traditional game journalism has got quite good at deriving meaning from a game, despite the lack of a single author.
Singular vision. I think that's the problem that a lot of people have with it, and I think it comes from the single authorship issue, is that people look at games and they think, well, this is completely dissonant. Drink, because, there's no obvious meshing of its mechanics and its theme and its story and its narrative, and maybe one of those elements is shite. But actually, as gamers, you're quite capable of compartmentalising that and
putting
each one on its own merits. But that's not something that's necessarily obvious to somebody who mostly experiences culture through art or high art.
But this is the thing, the great thing about games, the reason that games should be part of that discussion is because games allow you, if you're used to the idea of talking about how games work and as sort of subjective experiences or as undirected experiences, then you're suddenly way better at talking about how reading works.
Mm.
Because reading is a fundamentally undirected experience. It is an interactive experience that happens only in the mind of the reader. And to do so might be to align yourself with a particular school of literary criticism, but it's probably the right one. So there are reasons to want to talk about culture in that way, but it doesn't quite fit in terms of in what we have in terms of mainstream criticism of high art, quote unquote, at the moment. And that's a shame, because games have a huge amount to inform about it. It's not just that they belong there, it's that they actually inform it in a way that's really interesting.
This is slightly separate from that, but like, Seymour's first question is, why do people feel the need to mention such benefits to the public first and foremost when they are not the first reason that people play games? And that feels to me like that's just true across culture in general. Like, it feels like it used to be a case of culture was seen as beneficial for its own sake, that it humanized people, it increased empathy, it increased emotional intelligence to show people artworks of all kinds. But as we've whittled down rightly the boundaries between high and low culture, it feels like one of the trade-offs of that is that it's become kind of easy to dismiss just all culture as just junk, and therefore our society focuses more on science and the benefits of science. And so when we try to sing the praises of games, or really any cultural form, we don't talk about culture and its benefits for its own sake or in itself. We talk about tangential benefits. So games, it can't simply be that, you know, culture and artwork and these things make us more human. It has to be, it has a tangential scientific benefit that we can measure and test.
Also, I think it's about overlapping vocabularies. So you're trying to, you as a gamer are trying to find your overlapping vocabulary with that person as a, I am concerned about the medical, or, you know.
Yeah.
So you're just trying to find where do you overlap? Where do your Venn diagrams overlap? I also wonder whether all this stuff about media representation is a generational thing. We just haven't lived long enough yet. Because I'm wondering, like, even when Charlie Brooker tried to do a video game TV show, he still somehow started it off going, video games began as Pong. And then what the hell, how on earth that happened? I don't know whether, I don't know Brooker at all, so I don't know whether he was forced to do this by the network.
That is the largest rung.
People are wondering why, worrying about the not drinking, they can put their minds
at rest. The largest
people are worrying why my posts and RPS are unintelligible.
So, but even,
oh no, okay, that's the largest. Jesus Christ.
Well, this is like rum for not accepting a third glass.
No, I'm probably okay for the moment. I've still got some in my glass.
There's plenty left. This is the biggest bottle of rum I've ever seen.
I know, we didn't have to drink it all this evening.
But we have.
Yeah, okay. Sorry.
No, that's all right. So, but I was thinking, if even Brooker makes these same tiresome mistakes of just treating games as this alien artifact you're trying to explain to people who've never even heard of them before. I was so cross with that episode. I'm so glad it didn't get picked up to a series, because it would have just driven me insane. But he knows, the guy grew up playing video games. He used to be one of the best writers.
I can only assume that
something came in from above.
So, don't understand games.
When they're finally all dead or retired. Yeah. Then maybe we'll get the media representation.
But I don't understand. This is why I get frustrated with the BBC, though, because they don't have the commercial pressures that require them to make sure that everything is lowest common denominator.
Unfortunately, they hire middle managers from commercial channels.
But they also strictly come dancing is on 47 nights a week now.
I don't mind that, but why isn't BBC Three doing a regular documentary series about games which treats them...
Because they want a show documentary series about girls showing their boobs and throwing up in the street and somewhere in Spain.
They show documentary series about all sorts of things, and they find ways to make them fun and silly and interesting and lively and unusual and weird for an audience that doesn't understand this stuff.
But they're not doing it throwing up in Spain.
There should be a lot more games about that. Especially if you get to see some boobs.
That'd be good.
Nod rates. Dear crack crow, it's off to work we go.
That's nice. Good.
I suppose that should be crack crow.
It's off to work we go.
And stop.
On the forum thread discussing the latest Dota 2 patch.
Yes.
Bum bum bum. Marsh said, "You too, Marsh. It too, Marsh." Marsh said that he hadn't seen Chris. So here we go. This excited since the opening light of Les Miserables. It occurred to me that the only thing that might make Chris more excited would be if Les Mis itself received a radical patch. But what would that look like? This is the best question.
It is the best question we've ever received.
Les Mis and Lanes.
Personally, I think the dire side, the dire side, were a bit OP in the last version, and Le Radiant clearly didn't have the support chops to protect but carry. Gavroche, on the other hand, I was also disappointed in the lackluster AoE damage dealt by the Shafnarts. Swan Dive Ultra. Brigadoringly yours, Nod.
Brigadier. So this is the best question we've ever received.
I actually have some answers to this.
I've never seen Les Mis and I've never played.
Oh,
Dota
what the
2.
Fuck are you allowed?
It's
you
a
can't
common,
be on this podcast.
Common point of reference on this podcast because of Martin Chris.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're gonna have a sing along at the end of the podcast.
A sing along.
As we do
I dreamed a dream, John, and you've killed it.
So, I think that Fontaine, is massively underpowered. And really, the way to deal with this is to, obviously I think it's narratively important that she dies, but I think it would be better if she, emitted a massive explosion when she dies. I think it would switch it, the power dynamics a bit too much if it only affected the opposite side. So I think it should be friendly fire enabled, giving an opportunity to take out, both the main mid laners of either team, Javert and Jean Valjean. alternatively, I think Eponine should buff Marius for every tear that the audience sheds. Those are my suggestions.
Would it help if there was a better camera angle so that it wasn't, you know, from side on all the time? The camera moved around so you could see the goals.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love Les Mis, but over time, I have increasing problems with it. And something I'd like to see patched in would be, I'd like to see a victory condition for the well-meaning young rebels that took place, that allowed them to achieve the political aims they had in mind within the structures of a democratic society, as opposed to having to simply die and then be promised a kind of mega vague payoff for their endeavours in heaven. That, to me, seems like a bit of a cop-out.
Especially when that turns out to be the terror.
Yeah.
Which is not that great, really.
Yeah, like the whole, like, you know, can you hear the people sing Marching to the Light? Is like, well, great, but it does sort of smooth over the fact that you're all slaughtered by the police.
Hmm.
Ideally, there would be a way for you to democratically work out your differences with the government that you've received. In a way that didn't require a barricade, for example. Like, and this is particularly true in the film, the recent film of Les Mis, where that said barricade is represented in heaven as being the biggest, best barricade ever, which I don't think is what they were going for. Like, I don't think what their ideal was, you know, the most prominent barricade we've ever erected against the shit government, the shit intractable government of our country. But in fact, just one that worked, you know?
Yeah.
Is that too much to ask?
But what you're saying is you need to radically alter the way that creeps are farmed in Les Mis.
Basically, like, at least last hitting is meritocratic in a very basic way. If that was true in Les Mis, then they would actually be on a fairly good ratio.
But surely this is just coming back to what we were talking about earlier when talking about Shadowrun. Where not every choice you make needs to have huge, enormous consequences.
No.
Isn't it all right?
Actually, the bit where...
You can dream a dream, but still die.
There's the bit where, I've forgotten what the character says, Marius, what's wrong with you today? You look as if you've seen a ghost. He should actually be then possessed by a ghost that can actually help direct him through the rest of the plot. Maybe give Marius a respawn mechanic.
That'd be great, yeah. Maybe deliver a lot of exposition.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, an exposition delivering respawn ghost that helps Marius.
Is time travel involved at all? Because that would really set it off to a T.
If one of the people could possess a dog and use it to detect smells, would this solve the problem?
You possess Gavroche. And you control tiny Gavroche as he goes through vents. You know, I don't know, spying on gendarmes. I don't know what the fuck he would do. Then he gets shot, and that's a spur to action for everyone else to go and die.
Yeah, maybe just farm Gavroche over and over again, like Roche.
Gavroche. You could, if you die while holding a big flag, you get more points.
I just want to say, just sitting and watching this, that was beautiful. That was, ladies and gentlemen at home, that was not scripted. That was beautiful. I now want adventure games of 1940s and 50s Hollywood musicals.
Hey, the like, work here's done.
I would like a point and click the Barclays of Broadway, please.
Let's start an e-petition right now.
I've literally been sat here since the beginning of this conversation trying to figure out a 24601 joke. And being unable to do so, I just want to record it for the record. I can make a really niche Dota joke.
Go for it.
Okay. What if Doom's level death, instead of working on a factor of 2, in fact worked on a factor of 24601? There you go. Boom. There's literally one person in the Venn diagram of that joke, and it's me!
That's all the time for questions. Yeah.
Maybe, like, Dance Dance and American in Paris.
I haven't seen that.
It's good because it ends in a 10-minute ballet, so it works. The joke works.
Okay.
Also, it's got the bit where a man who's... Oscar Levant. Of course Oscar Levant does his one-man orchestra, which is the funniest scene in all of Hollywood history.
There should be a bit of GTA thing, you'll see, which is Jets versus Sharks. And Steam also. Kind of musical.
Still looking forward to musicals that came. You had a great idea for meshing that with RPG systems, Chris.
Mm.
And you should still pitch that to Harmonix at some point.
I did, and I do, because action is interchangeable with musical numbers. It totally is, in film, in games, and everything else.
Anyway, there is no great musical in video games, so there's travesty. And on that note...
Oh, I like it!
We should end this podcast, because that's all the time we have. You can send us questions if you want to questions@creightoncrowbar.com. You can send us them on the forum, which is creightoncrowbar.com/forum. You can send us them over the Twitters, which is @creightoncrowbar. I'm @MarshDavis, which is DAVIES. Who are you, John?
I am emailpodcast@romdoings.com.
No! What's your Twitter?
My Twitter is @botherer.
Yes.
@romdoings.
Oh, you just can't keep the plug out.
I can't. I know, it's when people listen to my shitty podcast that doesn't make any money.
That's great. You deserve it. No podcast makes any money. It's a secret.
So I'm sure it doesn't idle thumbs. Surely they're rolling.
As I said in the email for this very podcast, one cannot serve both pod and mammon.
This is true. I thought with the best pun I made in the podcast.
It's a good pun. Robin
email so
good.
Far.
It was.
I'm very proud of that.
Good. Anyway, best joke that no one listening to this will understand.
What's your Twitter address on them?
When did you use the Twitter website?
Okay, so it's http
right, okay.
Colon.
Which one's forward slash?
It's the one that starts on the bottom left and proceeds uprightly to the top right.
Okay. Not a hyphen.
Right. It's http:// not a semicolon, /// www.twitter.com / again. I know that's confusing, John, but bear with me.
Okay.
CTURSTEN. C Thurston, my initial and surname. That's right, Marsh. You look surprised, and for good reason, Graham.
Mine's at Gornis. GONAS.
Have a lead nearby! Have a lead nearby!
You